Senate Interim Committee on Human Services and Rural Health Policy will come to order, and thank you for being here this morning. I would put the shades up if we weren't going to be using the screen, because there will be sunshine today. So that's something to look forward to. Okay, Senator Mona Sanderson. Good morning.
Good morning. Nice to be back.
Yes, it is.
And stay away from all
there
those
will
campaigns.
Be people drifting in as we continue through our very long agenda, and we will start. Did you have anything that you wanted to?
No, Mr. Chair.
Oh, okay.
We're good to go this morning. Yes.
Right. Good. Okay. Okay. First on the agenda is an update from Seniors and People with Disabilities, Department of Human Services. James Taves, would you come up, please? Good morning, James.
Good morning. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, James Taves, Department of Human Services, Seniors and People with Disabilities. We are to report today on an updated report that basically outlines the activities we've continued to pursue in sort of our long-range planning. As you'll recall, Mr. Chairman, in 2006, originally the governor ordered the department to do a long-range plan to look at senior and disability services, given the demographic wave that is coming our way. In 2008, this committee sponsored a bill, I think it was Senate Bill 1061, that directed the department also to develop an additional long-range plan, which we delivered at the last legislative session. And then at the end of this last session, the co-chairs asked us again to deliver a report on what we thought the strategies would be to align services for seniors and people with disabilities, particularly given the resource outlook and revenue outlook in the coming years. And so we've tried to capture that in this report, and outlined not so much a plan as implementation strategies that are already underway in this regard. Again, the numbers are so compelling. We've talked about that many times before. The 65-plus age group in this state will double in less than 20 years, from about 500,000 to over 1 million. Of most significance is the 85-year-old plus group is one of the fastest growing groups. That group will nearly double as well. And of course, that has even a more significant impact then on the demand for long-term care services. I'm just going to highlight. I'm not going to go into the details. I'm just going to do an overview and then respond to questions. When you look at the senior and disability population that needs long-term care, every study, both in Oregon and nationally, says about 20% of the 65-plus population has some needs and activities of daily living. So about 20%, about a fifth of that population. Of those who have significant needs, daily needs and activities of daily living in three or more categories, it's about 5%. So it's a pretty small percentage of people that need really significant amounts of daily support in their daily living skills. When you look at who provides care, the state of Oregon, for example, and this is pretty much true nationally, it's only about 4% of that population that actually receives paid public assistance. All the rest of the caregiving, between 75 and 80% of caregiving, is done by families. So again, we serve a small minority of individuals who don't have families available. They have spent down all their resources, become Medicaid eligible. And that's a very important fact when you talk about strategies in the future about how are you going to support a population that's going to more than double. If people don't have family support, they spend down very, very quickly, even if they have some resources. If you go into a nursing home, you're on private pay. The cost is over $6,000 a month. if you need 3 or 4 hours of in-home care a day and you're paying for that yourself, it's probably almost $2,000 a month. So people very, very quickly, if they don't have family caregivers, begin to spend down.
That's a very, very important part of your testimony. And I really appreciate the detail that you went into throughout the entire 23 pages. And I guess the thing that concerns me is that if we can't keep people out of nursing homes, we're in big trouble. I mean, the bottom line is we are required to provide nursing home care for those who need it. And my concern is that with the upcoming shortfall, we not discontinue programs that will cost us more money in the long run that we have to fund. And that's the greatest concern. So how are we going to avoid that, James?
Well, a couple things. I was going to talk about that in a little bit of detail. So if the budget was stable, which it's not, but if the budget was stable, our strategies would be, and this is pretty much nationally, people have agreed what we need to do, and that's keep people out of nursing homes, continue to build a strong community-based care system. We've worked a lot with this committee over the years in updating rates for community facilities so they're competitive with private pay so we don't lose Medicaid capacity. We've launched in the last couple of years a big diversion effort. We've reallocated about 60 or 70 staff across the state to do nothing but help people being discharged from hospitals and relocating once they're in nursing homes. We've been able, even though we had that short window where the nursing home count started going up, we've been able to keep them down and to keep them declining. So that still remains the key strategy. We've reported several times in federal health reform, they didn't do much on long-term care, but they did a little bit around aging and disability resource centers, and a whole flurry of grants have been given to the states. And the goal essentially is, and both the centers on Medicaid and Medicare at the federal level and the Administration on Aging are really beginning to focus for the first time on the pre-spend-down group, saying if we can't keep people healthy, safe, independent at home before they spend down their own resources, and we simply wait until they all spend down, come into the Medicaid system, we will never be able to afford the huge cost with the doubling of that population, and we won't be able to build all the facilities, we won't be able to mount the kind of workforce to do that. So I think everyone has agreed, and there's seed funding at the federal level, but whether or not they're going to appropriate additional dollars, I think, remains to be seen, to basically do three things and have every state and every community do aggressive options counseling. So at the minute someone is in a hospital, breaks their hip, the family is in crisis, has done no planning, there are people there, not Medicaid caseworkers, which we do a good job of, but people there to assist that family and individual with extensive counseling on what kind of services to use, how to best preserve their resources, and that's something we do very, very little of. So that's the one strategy included in federal health reform. The second is nursing home diversion for the pre-Medicaid group, and quite frankly, it's almost like OPI. It's providing limited in-home relief care to the family caregivers, chore services, just that little bit of added help that can keep a person or the family intact before they spend down and need to go on Medicaid. And the third thing contained in federal health reform is healthy aging. In virtually all the states, there have been pilot programs on falls prevention and on chronic disease management. They're evidence-based, they're research-based, and the predictions are if you roll that out, take it to scale across the country, you can save billions of dollars just in the preventative side. So those are the strategies that everybody, and we have a lot of grants, and I could go into a lot of detail on the pilots we've already launched in Oregon, but those are the things we still feel we need to do no matter what our budget situation is. The other thing is we have launched a pilot in Oregon with Care Oregon, with one of the Medicaid-managed care plans, to do joint care coordination. We've co-located our case managers their nurse practitioners and staff to do a joint plan for people that have complex needs on both the long-term and the acute care side, the medical care side, people at risk of hospitalization, emergency room visits, things of that sort, to do a joint plan. And the goal there is to really demonstrate over time that we can keep the costs low and the quality of life high for this group if we literally swarm them with resources. And do daily kind of visits and chronic disease management and falls prevention and things of that sort. And that's incredibly important. If you look at, and probably the savings there in the long run will be on the Medicare side, not on the Medicaid side, but if you look at Medicare, about 20% of the people who have four or more chronic diseases spend almost 60-65% of all Medicare dollars. So if you just target on chronic disease...
Say that again? I'm sorry.
About 20% of seniors with four or more chronic diseases consume almost 66% of all Medicare dollars. So that's one fact. The second fact is 5% of Medicare beneficiaries die every year. But in that end of life, that 5% group spends almost 30% of the entire Medicare budget. So we're spending an enormous amount of health dollars on people with chronic diseases that can be managed and managed well. And if they're not, they end up in emergency rooms, they end up in hospitalizations, and we spend enormous amounts of money at end of life. So again, if we can begin to coordinate both the long-term care and the acute care side, and that's the demonstration we're trying to do with Care Oregon, with a lot of research associated with that, we think in the long run that we can better serve the population, save money, have a higher quality of life. And of course, the state doesn't get the Medicare savings. Those are savings to the federal side. But there's increasing talk about from the federal government about whether the state should manage both the Medicaid and the Medicare side, but that's a longer range probably proposition.
Yeah, Senator Winters.
What part of the state are we doing the pilot, and how much is it costing?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I can get you that information real quickly. We've done a series of pilots on falls prevention and chronic disease management in I think five or six counties. They've been federal grants, and I can get you the detail on that.
Is a part of that information? I know you're talking about fall prevention, but there's other, and the four chronic diseases that you're also that have a higher risk, and a part of that information.
We can tell you, yes, what we're doing in chronic disease management and what kind of diseases. And there's an evidence-based course out of Stanford that we use, which is a whole series of instructions and peer counseling for people on how to manage chronic diseases. And we actually have the percentages of the number of people who have participated and what the research shows in terms of those savings. So, yes, we can absolutely get you that.
I guess my interest is I know the national stats that would come out of the university system, but, you know, you talked about the joint partnership with Care Oregon. I'm interested in, you know, what is actually taking place in Oregon and what kind of successes they may or may not be having.
Okay. Yes, we can absolutely get you that.
Okay,
the other thing that we're beginning to focus on is the CLASS Act. It was part of federal health reform. It was one of the last things of Senator Kennedy in the Health Reform Act. CLASS Act stands for Community Living Assistance Services and Support. And it's long-term care insurance, like Social Security. It'll be a payroll deduction. You are automatically enrolled, but you can opt out. And that's an important fact. The Health and Human Services at the federal level has yet to define the premiums and the benefits, although the bill says the benefits, once you're vested, and there's a five-year vesting period, have to equal at least up to $50 a day that you could then use to pay for your own support, like a home care worker or chore services or things of that. It's supposed to start January 1st. The federal government is just organizing the office. It's going to administer this. There's no rules out yet. But all the states are looking at this, whether there's an approach where we really ought to make this a high priority, work with employers, perhaps offer incentives for employers to help with the premiums. In the long run, if long-term care insurance can become something that typically people have not used historically, but if through the class act it can become a broad way of providing part of the support for long-term care insurance, we want to really pursue that. But again, we're watching very carefully what the federal government will do and how they will set this program up.
The other pilot project, in a sense, was the ADRC's Adult and Disability Center and so on. And it started, the first project was in Lane County, and now there are a number of other counties involved.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, we have three different ADRC grants now, and it pretty much covers the Mid-Valley, and we're in the middle of a strategic plan that says how will we fully roll out aging and disability resource centers statewide within 5 years. And again, they are to do the three things, the options counseling, the nursing home diversion, OPI-like, and healthy living chronic disease management.
Okay. In Lane County, Oregon Healthcare Association, the Lane Community College, Trillium Insurance, Areas for the Aging, Senior Health Insurance Benefits Program, and so on. So there's a broad consortium. That's the New Front Door. There are various names that were used to get those programs started, but it's kind of a wraparound service to assist seniors.
Correct, Mr. Chairman. And in Lane County, it had a twist on hospital discharge planning, too, a real focus on people coming out of hospitals to try to make sure they can get back home with proper supports.
I had a constituent who called me about 2 years ago, and she was a cancer patient. Her oncology center, her doctor, who happened to be on vacation at the time, when she received the letter from the Oregon Health Plan, or basically saying that she was not eligible for continued service, she had gone through the chemo process, and they thought that wasn't going to help her, but the pills would. Unfortunately, the pills got something like $8,000 a month. We did a lot of work on that. Tim Baxter, who is the Legal Aid Society, helped a lot, and we talked to the Oncology Center. And basically, it was kind of like a death panel. You're going to die. And the letter that was sent to her said, but we're going to cut you off of these services, but you still have access to hospice. And unfortunately, nobody held her hand and told her that when she got the news, and so it was pretty traumatic. One of the things that happened is a company that made the medication consented to give it to her free for a year, and I understand that some of those companies, or several that do that, will step in if the patient can't afford it. Unfortunately, she died 2 months after that. But, I mean, it was one of those things that we, the cost of continuing, to live is beyond reach. And so the only alternative, they know they're going to die, and it's a very traumatic kind of thing to face. Yeah. So it's, that was the second person that I had talked to in that situation. So it is frustrating.
So, Mr. Chairman, before I get to your question about how we're going to manage the budget in these times of declining revenue, I need to mention also, in terms of all of our planning, that 40% of everybody we serve in long-term care is also under age 65. So a lot of people with disabilities, it's not only the aging phenomenon, and we have the entire developmental disabilities community that has completely restructured itself. The institutions are closed. 24-hour services are sort of capped, and you only get in through an emergency, but we have rolled out the Staley agreement, and we're almost close to having everybody enrolled as part of that legal mandate. So, I mean, that's a real historic point in time in how the whole DD system was restructured. So,
okay. There's another issue that you mentioned in here, and I'm looking for it. It's money follows the people. I also have a constituent who happens to live in Bend, who built a...
That would be my constituent then.
No, she lives in... Excuse me. She lives in Springfield.
Oh, okay.
Her husband lives in Bend, and they together they run a adult foster home, and they received money under the program to remodel their adult foster home to be able to receive seven or eight people who were severely disabled 24/7 who came from the nursing homes.
Right.
And you did meet with her in Lane County, and apparently her problem hasn't been solved, but apparently there's a glitch in the program that required you to suspend it for a while, and I'm kind of curious about it.
Mr. Chairman, Money Follows the Person is, it's actually a wonderful program. It's an innovative program out of Medicaid. It was originally authorized by Congress in 2005, and it was reauthorized in federal health reform. And what it does is Medicaid, for the very first time, can actually pay for transition costs, startup costs, housing modifications, special equipment. None of that used to be doable under the Medicaid program. You could only pay for the actual service rates. When we closed Fairview, for example, and moved hundreds of people with developmental disabilities, all those transition costs had to be general fund only. Medicaid would pick up the actual service rate. So this is a very innovative design that came out of Congress. Oregon applied. We started receiving funding in 2008. We have about $40 million that's available over the life of this grant, and there's even points where we can apply for supplemental funding. I think we've expended about $14 million of that $40 million. So far, we've moved about 267 people. Mm-hmm. In the last couple of weeks, there were some expenditure categories that we found very disturbing. And so we temporarily halted new development of the program. And we have an investigation going on under the umbrella of the Department of Justice. I think you all received a letter from Dr. Goldberg, and we'll come out with all the details of that just as quickly as we can. Our goal is to reopen the program. If there are major problems with it, to correct those. But it's a very, very valuable resource because it does allow us for the first time to leverage federal dollars in those important transition costs.
Good. Thank you. Questions?
What will happen to, and I went in knowing that you suspended the activity for a while, what will happen to those facilities who started the process of remodeling or doing something with their facilities in order to comply and thought that they were going to get funds? What will happen to those? Because I think there was one in Senator Johnson's district, yeah, as well as over in Bend.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Winters, we're going to have to work through those on a case-by-case basis. We're not suspending the funding for projects that are underway. So it's important to say that like the home you were referring to or in your district, so we're not cutting off funds for existing programs. We're simply stopping new development. But Senator Winters is absolutely correct. There were some projects that had already expended some of their own dollars, and so right now that's the issue that we're going to have to resolve.
Other comments, questions?
Mr. Chairman, the last thing I wanted to mention is the other thing that happened in federal health reform, which is going to create a huge issue for Oregon, is federal health reform does not allow a state to change eligibility for health care services under Medicaid. In long-term care, you come in at 300% of SSI, which is about $1,900 a month, so it's a higher income threshold than typically people that go on the Oregon Health Plan, and that's obvious because long-term care services are so expensive. And to become Medicaid eligible, you're under that income level. You have to spend down to $2,000 in assets. And that eligibility now has to be absolutely preserved. So in the next biennium, based on our caseload projections, we're going to have about another 10-plus% increase in our caseload. at the same time that we're preparing 15, 20, 25% reductions. In 2003, we cut eligibility. It was a very, very painful reduction, but we cut service levels, cut about 5,000 or 6,000 people out of eligibility, along with rate cuts and other things. This time, that's not available to us. So at the very same time that we're going to cut staff, cut our offices, we're already cutting AAAs, counties, and others, and the state staff, and we've already started some painful rate reductions on the developmental disability side. All of the reductions for next biennium have to either come out of staff in the central office in the field or rates out of providers. We can't touch eligibility. And the Centers on Medicaid and Medicare, and this is a debate happening in every state, the Centers on Medicaid and Medicare, if you're doing rate changes in your Medicaid reimbursed services, you have to get approval from CMS, from the Centers on Medicaid and Medicare, and they're making you guarantee that you're not going to impede access and you're not going to compromise health and safety. And we're waiting to see now. We're assuming they're going to approve the first round of developmental disability rate cuts in our 24-hour system and other areas that are to go into place October 1st. But all of the reductions we've laid out for next biennium will require federal approval. And there's increasing concern that they may say, well, if you can't prove that that won't impede access and compromise health and safety. So we're in a very difficult box in long-term care as we approach the next biennium because we cannot change in federal health reform the eligibility. That anchor is absolutely unmovable, and everything will have to then push out. So to your question of how are we going to manage that, and then the other issue for us is the mandatory Medicaid service. If a state takes a penny of Medicaid, you have to provide a nursing home benefit. So ultimately, all the eligibility points right at a nursing home. So if you cut your in-home hours or you cut rates to community-based care, they can't serve people with complex needs, or they can't stay at home because you've cut the in-home hours. All the hydraulics then start pushing into more expensive parts of your system.
How about the maintenance of standard for programs that are required for federal funding?
Maintenance of effort.
The maintenance of effort programs.
Mr. Chairman, the maintenance of effort is on eligibility.
I know. Well, what I'm saying is in order to receive other federal funding, we have to maintain our effort in certain areas, correct?
Mr. Chairman, correct.
Now, and that limits cuts that can be made.
Mr. Chairman, in the Medicaid program, we have some requirements for the SSI and other populations, but we can cut Medicaid rates. There's no maintenance of effort per se there, other than your rates have to be adequate to meet the people's needs and to assure that they have access. But other than that, the maintenance of effort, unlike TANF or some other areas where we have specific targets. We have targets for maintenance of effort in the Older American Act program, for example, but not in the Medicaid program in general.
Well, I'm. What about the Older American Act then, the maintenance of effort? What are the programs that we must continue?
And, Mr. Chairman, I think in the Older American Act program, Oregon receives, I think, close to $34 or $35 million. I think our maintenance of effort required in state general fund is about $3.5-4 million, so it's not a large amount.
Okay. Other questions?
Mr. Chair, just it's so frustrating for the feds to say you've got to do this, you've got to do this, requiring us to come up with revenue, and we are in a desperate economic situation, and I wish the states could just rebel and somehow get the feds to
secede.
Open their eyes, saying you cannot let us not be a little creative in trying to meet the needs of those most vulnerable here in the states.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Monis Anderson, Margaret Carter and I spent a week on the Hill about a month and a half ago meeting with our delegation and a lot of other folks as well and staffers from the different committees. And we said over and over again, all the stimulus is going away, so all the enhanced federal match is going away. You've now locked down eligibility, so we have to serve everybody that comes through the door. And you're saying your federal agencies won't approve significant rate reductions. It's exactly the point we made. We're in an absolute hammerlock here. And, I mean, the comments over and over again is Congress just is fatigued at having to bail out the states. And I just wanted to say, you know, we're not talking about Japan. I mean, we are you. These are actions at the federal and state level that have to be resolved. And a lot of the other states were there as well and are facing the same cliff we are and don't know what to do. It's like there's no way to navigate out of this. We know the revenue won't be there, but in each direction we look, we're saying we're being told you can't do that. So.
Just a follow-up.
Yeah.
I thought it was very interesting. I heard some comments made by Dr. Goldberg that, and I want to know if it's true for aging and disabilities, that at least in Department of Human Services, out of all of the money they get, only about 7% goes to actual state personnel. The rest of the money is actually going into the communities. They are paying for case providers, they are paying for in-home help, et cetera. And I was wondering, is that true for your budget in that most of the money that's coming into the department is actually going out into the communities? They are paying for people, and that means providers, and that means hospitals, that means doctor's offices. So it isn't like the state is just keeping all this money with all of this big government. We're actually giving this money into the community. And because I think that's what the public has to hear also. Because everyone says, oh, we're getting more money. Well, we just have to cut the salaries and cut employees, when actually that is going to providers in the community.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Monis Anderson, yeah, it's well over 85, almost 90% of everything that goes out goes to mostly our provider system, so assisted living, nursing homes, the home care program, group homes for people with developmental disabilities, the Staley Agreement, those are all dollars that go out. And in terms of staffing on the senior and disability side, most of our field is local government. It's area agencies on aging. It's county government that run the DD programs. And what we do on the state side is in rural areas or in the coast, you know, we still maintain some state offices for Medicaid if area agencies have declined to do that. But the vast majority of that entire budget goes straight out to counties, local government, and our entire provider system.
And that's a good thing.
Yeah.
That's a very good thing.
Yeah.
It's important both for the people they serve and for local economies as well.
I will read the paragraph that you sent us on September 9th. As I mentioned, on July 29th, matter, several events have intervened since we started the process. Federal health reform has frozen existing long-term care eligibility in a maintenance of effort requirement. This has completely altered our thinking, at least for the short term, on how to triage increasingly demand over the limited resources. In fact, the MOE requirement severely limits our options in reducing the long-term care expenditures as we face the budget cliff. Now, you've covered that pretty much, but you that was a wake-up call.
Yeah.
But what can we do about it, though, is the problem. So it's a triage situation. You have to decide how you're going to use the limited resources. Other comments, questions?
Just to follow up on the good senator, sometimes taking federal dollars isn't the best thing to take, because with those federal dollars comes all the strings and also comes the hammer later on, and I think we're facing that. And it's not just long-term care, it's the whole federal system. And it reminds me of when education talks about us sending them unfunded mandates. These are unfunded, become unfunded mandates. And the states are left holding the bag, you know, in education. I think that a proportion that's coming from the federal government is about 7%. And so, but the dance, or being able to comply, is greater than 7%. So I think there's some prudency when I can recall the days I was here on the executive side years ago, and legislators would look at all the federal dollars with the eye of whether or not it actually enhanced our own objectives. And if they did not, we weren't taking them. And there's some prudency in that kind of a process, because you then later you're not on the hook. But it is true, we're going to have one, states are going to have one heck of a time trying to meet the demands that are inside of our state and provide the services that are necessary and needed for our people, our seniors and people with disabilities. And I'm glad you're giving us the wake-up. This wake-up call should have occurred before today, really. And educating our population, both the community as well as some of our learned individuals in these chambers, it's very helpful.
Well, and there was another ominous note that was sent to us saying that the $2.3 billion shortfall in this next biennium would probably be followed by several more shortfalls in future bienniums that may not be quite that big, but will be severe. So what our fix is, you know, may not be a temporary fix. I mean, it may be a temporary fix, because it could get worse.
Okay.
Other comments?
Okay.
Thank you very much. And we will hear from you in December as well, right? Okay, an update in long-term care ombudsman's office. Mary Jagger, there you are.
Good morning.
Good morning. I just want to say that the information that you send out, I thought was very, very, very good. Complete.
Thank you.
Eye-opening. I was not aware of the details that you included. But we have a long way to go, right?
We do have a long way to go.
Yeah, okay.
But I want to thank you for inviting me to come speak to all of you. The committee, you all received this report.
Please.
Oh, I'm sorry. I apologize. Mary Jagger, Long-Term Care Ombudsman for Oregon.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, sir. And what I thought I'd do is just for the record read the summary and then address any questions that you all may have. Is that okay?
Yeah.
Okay. So I wanted to talk a little bit about seniors in Oregon, just to paint the picture of where the seniors are, which means where the licensed care facilities are, which dictates where our volunteers need to be. So seniors in Oregon, the senior population in our state is growing much more rapidly than the total population of our state. There are 519,501 persons aged 65 and older in Oregon in 2010, which is, 13.4% of the estimated statewide total population of over 3 billion people today. Excuse me. Today, one in every 7.4 Oregonians is over the age of 65. In the next 5 years, our total population is projected to grow at 1% per year, while our 65-plus population is projected to grow at 3.6% per year. And as our baby boomers start to celebrate their 65th birthdays in 2011, the growth in our senior population will accelerate and continue increasing through the mid-2020s. So you can see the wave is coming. The share of our state's population over 65 will increase from our present 13.4% to well above 20% by the year 2030, when at least one of every five Oregon residents will be 65 or older. That is a dramatic statistic for us to consider. Curry County in Oregon is our oldest county, with 28.4% of its citizens over the age of 65. And Washington County is our youngest county, with just 9.3% of our its citizens over 65.
Mr. Chair, and what year was this data based on?
This data is based on...
In what year?
2010, right now.
This is 2010 census stuff. Okay.
Projected growth in the senior population. With the exceptions of Deschutes and Crook counties, the highest concentration of seniors and most of the projected growth in our senior population is occurring in northwestern Oregon. In declining order, Multnomah, Lane, Washington, Clackamas, and Marion counties have 53% of the seniors. Just 10 counties have 75% of the total, if you think about that. 9 of these 10 counties are in western Oregon, and Deschutes County is the only eastern Oregon is the only eastern county in the top 10. Deschutes and Crook counties have the highest projected senior population growth rates between 2010 and 2015, so this five-year period going forward. The 65-plus population is projected to grow by 31.3% in Deschutes County and by 29.7% in Crook County. 5 other counties have projected 65-plus growth rates of more than 20% in that five-year period.
I'm sorry that Senator Telfer is not here because I imagine that it's because of the
in migration.
It's a retirement area, I guess. People are choosing to go there, but I would have suspected the coastal regions to be the hot spots for in-migration.
Well, if you want warm weather consistently, except for in the wintertime, you go to Central Oregon.
Yeah,
it's similar to if you did a tracking, you'd probably go back and find out where that senior population came in.
That would be interesting, and I will ask her that question later.
Because, and Mr. Chair, yes. There was a good article, I can't remember which paper, I think the Oregonian, and talking about the effects of sunlight and vitamin D and how it all, in those areas, Deschutes, they have that sunlight, and it is looking at decreasing chronic care and depression and mental health issues. So,
okay, we ought to move the capital over there.
There we go. Well, let me talk a little bit about senior income levels. Senior household income levels in Oregon vary greatly between the counties. Benton County has the highest 75-plus senior household income at a little over $46,000, and the statewide average is $31,990. In eastern Oregon, only Deschutes County exceeds the statewide average with over $32,000. The 75-plus senior households in 9 Oregon counties have an average annual income below $25,000 per year. In declining order, those are Malheur, Baker, Coos, Curry, Wallowa, Union, Umatilla, Crook, and Harney counties. The 75-plus senior households in Harney County are estimated to have average household incomes of $21,547 per year in 2010. So let's move on to the licensed long-term care facilities in Oregon. Currently, we have about 2,274 licensed long-term care facilities.
Question.
Yes, ma'am.
Because we jumped from the 65 age group to the 75 age group, and what's the difference if one was 65 in their average income in these counties that you identified, and then when they became 75, because it, you know.
Well, as we know, as people age, the chronic disease number tends to increase and tends to increase dramatically. So if you look at our young 65 to 75-year-old population versus our aging 75 and plus and needy population, you can see why that is something for all of us to take under advisement.
Well, I'm just wondering if there's some other dynamics in play by the time you get to be 75, maybe a spouse has left, and you're then on one income rather than the two.
Certainly.
You know, what other variables are in
there? Or family members are no longer nearby or never were family members, and social supports tend at that point to start disintegrating unless someone has really made an active effort to be part of a bigger community. So.
And your tax bracket changes when you're When you're single, and even if you're 65 or 75, you go into the single tax bracket and you move from 9% to 75, and you've dropped income.
Now, right. I don't know how much time you're going to take on that summary, but we don't have, we're on a time constraint here, so.
Let me just talk about where the beds are.
Okay.
Currently, we have 2,274 licensed long-term care facilities in Oregon, and that includes 140 nursing homes, 209 assisted living, 235 residential care, and 1,690 non-relative adult foster homes. All of these facilities have about 42,590 licensed beds, and those are the beds that fall under the jurisdiction of our office. And the average nursing home has about 85 beds, assisted living has about 67 beds, residential care has about 38 beds, and the average non-relative adult foster home has about 4.7 beds. Let me talk to you a little bit about our office. The Long-Term Care Ombudsman Office exists in every state in the United States. We are mandated by the Older Americans Act. Oregon's had a program since the early 80s. There are 10 and a half FTEs in our office, and we work with about 150 volunteers, 132 of which have gone through an extensive 48-hour training and are then assigned, screened and assigned to serve a number of licensed care facilities in the area where they live. And I'll stop with that.
Well, okay, I don't want to cut you off from
okay.
important information. What I'd like you to address are the concerns that you have about lack of staff. And also, I think it would be interesting for us to take a look at some of the maps that are here. We all have the packet on page 9. Population by there are maps, but tell us what the problems are in terms of staffing and lack of access for people who live in rural areas, and the fact that you hired a full-time person now to go out and recruit volunteers. And one of the things that when it comes to budget time, if we cut programs, we don't realize that if we cut staff, we're losing volunteers. And it,
yes.
In order to have volunteers, you have to have staff to go out and recruit them and help them and so on.
And
so those are the kinds of things. I know how important it is. I had a phone call from someone in a relative who lives in Roseburg, and someone who worked in her office said her father was being starved to death in a nursing home because the brother wanted to inherit the property, and there was a big battle over power of attorney and so on. And so I called your office, and you sent a person out there, the person who probably lives in the Roseburg area, and the report was very good. I mean, it was not happening the way this daughter said it was, and part of it was because of misperception, and they don't want people visiting during the lunch hour because people don't eat. There were some interesting side things going on that your ombudsman's person was able to correct, and that was wonderful. So that was a personal first-hand experience that I've had with your office. So
I appreciate hearing that.
Yeah.
Let me try to take all of those questions in one.
Okay.
Our staff, our 10 and a half staff, which also includes me, each work with 20 to 30 volunteers. And these volunteers are largely retired Oregonians, many of whom have had four or five careers. We have CEOs, we have physicians, we have lots of retired teachers, very, very sharp, dedicated folks. And when they go out to respond to a call, like the one you described, Senator, they've had 48 hours of training, and then depending how long they've been with the program, really have been able to gather some discernment skills to decide, is this something that I need to investigate as an adult protective services type call, which we're not. We're advocates, not regulators. So in that case, they would turn it immediately over to APS. Or is it something that they can help that resident negotiate through the system that they're living in, if it's a nursing home or if it's assisted living or foster care? But lest you think that these are simply just friendly little visits going out to sit with older people, We are required by the feds to document every visit and have been given a list of 132 different codes that a visit can be described by. So anything from what you described, Senator, a question about guardianship, a question about food, a question about basic living environments, to lost dentures, lost teeth, lack of payment, fear of retribution, on and on and on. So those reports, just in case you're interested, are all listed on our website, how we compare with other states in terms of complaints. To your other question, Senator, about staffing, our folks who work at our office work with 20 to 30 volunteers apiece. And even with that, we are only covering half of the beds in Oregon. According to a 2008 study, Oregon's staff per volunteer ratio is the lowest in the country. And while we've been trying to be compliant with the allotment directives, any more cuts will take my staff away. And one staff going means 20 to 30 volunteers as well, because of that multiplier effect of how our staff works with volunteers. So I know you have many people describing tragedy, where they work and how they serve folks. But the neat part of our office is that it's largely volunteer-based. So even though there are only 10 and a half FTEs, we really work with 160 all but FTEs, because so many of our volunteers work 10, 15, 20, 25, 40 hours a week just to be advocates for people who maybe don't have family members or maybe don't have family members nearby.
You mentioned, I think you mentioned power of attorney.
Yes, sir.
How do you deal with that?
Well, you'll hear more from Judge Welch as one of your next speakers about the role of guardianship in Oregon. But every guardianship that happens in Oregon, our office is copied on. So we send a volunteer to the facility where they're living to have sort of a general, regular, you know, regular Oregonian's eye on the question that is before the court. And then the volunteer reports back.
I'm sorry. There are several interesting maps. One of them is on page 26, which deals with the need, greatest need. Let's see. Multnomah County has 24 volunteers and needs 28 more. Harney County, they have zero and they need one. Malheur has zero and they need three. So I can understand why it would be hard then to cover all of. So do you have? Okay, this is an accurate map of where you are right now.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
And if you think about Eastern Oregon, again, most of the beds are west, in Western Oregon, and biggest concentration of beds is in the Tri-County area. However, our mandate is not just where the population is. And sometimes if you look at huge numbers versus isolated facilities, you can see the need is dramatic in both. We are really concentrating our efforts for volunteers in Eastern Oregon because, again, one or two more volunteers in certain counties in Eastern Oregon would make for much better response time for those particular residents in need. And again, to give, as the kids say, a shout-out to our folks in Eastern Oregon, those volunteers, I mean, it's nothing to drive 80 miles one way to go visit a resident.
Mm-hmm. Well, I notice Wasco County has no volunteers but need five. Thank you for pointing that out. Grants Pass, or Josephine County, on the other hand, has nine, and they don't need any more.
They're doing very well. On the other hand, in a place like that, with more volunteers, it would mean less running around for the actual volunteers themselves and people having much more time to go into in-depth follow-up with individual residents.
Now, it's interesting because I introduced a bill 2 years ago, and it did pass at the request of it wasn't at the request of the ombudsman, but she was okay with it, and it required that the departments could not withhold information from the ombudsman's office. which sounds like a no-brainer, but apparently it isn't, that if you want information, they have to give it to you, even though they may not want to divulge whatever. So,
well, Senator, in committee, it is well documented in Oregon statute and the administrative rules what the access is for our office.
Mm-hmm.
And so sometimes it just takes a little more explanation that, no, we're not randomly here visiting your facility, but yes, we do have statutory and regulatory authority. Mm-hmm. And once people really review the records or speak to their management in the facilities, that generally tends to be less of a problem. But sometimes it's a big surprise to people that there is actually statutory authority for it.
Senator Winters has a long history in ombudsman work, right?
Yeah, my husband started the nursing home ombudsman program back in 1974, I think it was. Mm-hmm. And then I was the ombudsman for the state. But I do have a question because I'm going through, and I'm assuming that your annual or your biennial report will talk about trends and problems that are being encountered during your nursing home visit, not just the number of facilities and the number of visits, but actually if we're having some trends or if they're problems, if they're not problems, you know, what are the gravity of what the volunteers are finding?
Yes, Senator. And in fact, right now there is the report from the last biennium has been put on our website. I've been very insistent on keeping transparency both for any citizen wondering or any legislator. But our year will end at the end of September. So the federal fiscal year starts October 1st. And we trend those by quarter, half year, and what we find tends to be very similar to the rest of the United States.
I guess another way of putting the question, when I was the ombudsman, part of my responsibility was to alert legislators if there were some egregious activity out in the communities, so that you're getting ahead of, for all practical purposes, you're not waking up in the morning and you're seeing these big headlines in the newspaper, so legislators are on board where there is some kind of problem. I don't mean going to a website and what have you. And then annually, I mean biennial, there is a report that was given I think websites have made, all agencies are saying it's up on website. Well, legislators
Senator Winters, the entire legislature received a report in July written by the chairman of our advisory committee who just finished in June. And then our intent would be to send certainly an interim report in December and then another one next July. The concerns we find are a lot about guardianship, a lot about Medicaid move-out, asking residents to move out without proper notice, staffing concerns on all shifts, particularly in memory care buildings, food concerns, interaction with staff concerns, and on from there. But those are literally the top five that continue to appear no matter where we are in the state. But I'll make sure that we follow up and that the next report will be sent in December.
Thanks.
Senator Edwards.
Thank you. Mary, I have two questions.
Mm-hmm.
First, in these counties that have no ombudsman, what are ombudsmen from other counties, surrounding counties, coming down to that, or just is there no presence?
Literally. So the state is divided into about seven regions. Each of our staff members supervise, are really the go-to person for that region, and then work with the volunteers who also live in that region. So the first line of defense is to send a volunteer. If a volunteer can't go, then a staff member themselves will go from Salem to follow up on that. And you can imagine that time lag is certainly distressing if you're that person making the call. But to my point earlier, literally we have some volunteers who are so devoted, they don't mind driving 80 to 100 miles to go look in on the needs of a resident. Very impressive.
So my second follow-up question is there a correlation, and you know, maybe you don't have hard data, but anecdotally, is there a correlation between how urbanized the population is and the number of problems or incidents that ombudsmen are called to. And the reason I ask is because I have one of those districts where I represent both a small community in Junction City and then in Eugene. And the flavor between the two, although they're only 15 miles apart, is night and day. I mean, Junction City, everybody knows one another, and they tend to just take care of one another, and they don't tend to call on public agencies to help each other out. They just kind of do it themselves. Whereas in Eugene, neighbors don't know one another and are much less connected and much more look to public agencies and whatnot. So I'm looking for some sort of anecdotal commentary on that, and maybe you don't have any. But
well, Senator, I think you actually just described it. It really depends on the community, the kind of leadership in the level of care, and what that community volunteerism or church relationships or just general neighborliness is of the community. I will tell you, though, that the points I made earlier about staffing and guardianship and move-outs are across Oregon, and it is not unique to urban population size. And I can also provide you with specific information from your district at another point.
Good. Other questions, comments? Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks for your support of our volunteers.
I really, really think this is a great report that you made. It gives lots of really good information. So thank you.
You're welcome.
We're going to change the order a bit because we're going to go to the conservatory now, because that is in keeping with what we're talking about, and then we will come back to the presentation from the Governor's Commission on Senior Services. So Mike Demereaux with Drew, Representative Demereaux and others. So, you can answer my question. No, go ahead and introduce
yourself.
Yes,
we'll try to. Thank you, Mr. Chair, honorable senators. My name is Michael Demereaux. I'm state representative for House District 45, which is Northeast Portland out to Park Rose. And I'm also a member of the House Human Services Committee, and in that capacity found myself appointed to the Task Force on Public Guardianship and Conservatorship, which came about as a result of some legislation that passed last session, House Bill 2883, dealing with some of, really the poorest of the poor, the most challenging of the challenged, who throughout this state are lacking in public guardianship that they really need in order to get the care that they need in a variety of settings. This committee was put together, an excellent committee, bringing together people from a variety of backgrounds, some of whom with some real expertise in this area. Fortunately, we prevailed upon Judge Betsy Welch to chair the task force. She has a long history in family law and has really done great things with this committee, which I have to tell you has been the poorest of the poor in terms of the resources of this committee. We have no staff and, really literally no budget at all. And so it's all been voluntary, and the report that's being produced is a group effort by the volunteers on the committee. It's been a real challenge, but it's such an important subject that people have really prevailed and have met regularly for the last 2 years. And Judge Welch will give you a kind of status report of what the preliminary recommendations of the task force are, particularly given our budget situation, what's really feasible, but how we can keep working on this issue and keep it moving, ultimately with the goal of coming up with a program that gives Oregonians what they need.
You didn't start from scratch, because some counties like Multnomah and others have already have the program. Which counties?
Well, you'll hear, and Judge Welch will talk about it, but particularly Multnomah County, really Multnomah County is the only county in the state that really has a public guardianship program. Okay. And if that kind of model could be expanded, it would be a wonderful thing.
Okay. It wasn't as simple as just taking their what they're doing and having it replicated. More complicated than that.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, Senators. My name is Betsy Welch. I am a senior circuit court judge, retired just a few years ago. I was the chief probate judge in Multnomah County for several years, 15, I think it was, before I retired. And I think that's the reason why somebody decided I needed to be on this committee, because as a result of being the probate judge in the only county with a public guardian program, I have a sort of unusual perspective on the subject, and I'm hoping to be able to give you a sense of what difference it makes to have a public guardian system, even an underfunded one, and one it's not nirvana in Multnomah County. It's just better than everywhere else.
Let me ask you a question. Do you have any anecdotal information about interaction with the Office of Ombudsman?
No.
Okay.
No, I don't.
But they're parallel. I mean, they do. They well.
No.
Maybe there's not enough of a connection.
There could be a connection. I have to say, in Multnomah County, that the Ombudsman's Office visits the probate department of the court and gets information about people who are the subject of a guardianship. But in terms of being actively involved in the court aspects, which is what I would know about, it's modest. There is some involvement. Sometimes the ombudsman representative will come to a hearing to observe. I don't remember in my 14 years anyone ever asking to testify, but I could have forgotten.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
I included in the little bit of material that I sent you for this morning a roster of the people that are on here, and I want to just say a little bit more than Representative Dimbro did about that, in that it is it's a wonderful selection of people, and I can say that because I didn't have had nothing to do with picking them, that it really does cover the ground in terms that we have a prosecutor, we have two judges, we have lots of people in the system, we have advocates for the disabled. I mean, it really does cover it. And
with Mary Yeager as well.
And Mary, of course, from Mary Yeager is also a member. We worked very hard, despite our lack of resources to do so, met regularly. We had issues to resolve. We not only had Multnomah County as a model, which we certainly do, but we also had the rest of the country. There are public guardian programs in most states. None of them are statewide and thoroughly well-funded, so it's all kind of fragmentary. But we read the literature, we consulted with national experts, so we knew what the issues were, knew what the concerns were, what the experience was, and there was a lot of material there to absorb and deal with. And just to make sure that everybody knows what we're talking about, the people that are the subject of a public guardian program are people who need a guardian, by definition, that's the first thing. But they are people who suffer from chronic, severe mental health conditions, persons who are developmentally delayed, adults, only adults, seniors with dementia and other age-related conditions, who are without family or resources to solve their need for guardianship services on their own or without public involvement. And one of the things that I think is also important to understand is that people in these kinds of circumstances are not necessarily particularly cooperative or willing to accept services. APS will go out on a call. They will find someone in circumstances that would probably end up being an appropriate case for this. People don't think they'll have a problem. They like things just the way they are. Get out of here. And, of course, the preservation of one's independence is an extremely high priority for most human beings, and that really comes home to roost in this context. So we're dealing with people who are not waiting for us to come and help them. We are dealing with people who have not been willing to accept any help of any significance, or at least if they did, it didn't work. One of our biggest problems in providing you with a report and getting a handle on this subject is data. Both nationally and locally, we don't have very good data. And we can speculate about why that's the case, but people don't keep track, agencies don't keep track of people they can't help. It's kind of what it boils down to. The national statistics are very fragmentary, and of course we didn't have any money to do a needs assessment, and I think if we had had the money to do it, I'm not sure we would have been all that, you know, that really would have gotten us that far, because they have been done in other states and the results are not very, they're not very helpful, I guess would be the best way to say that. Let me give you some insight into what practical aspects of this. You know that Adult Protective Service functions in every Oregon county. In 2009, APS statewide got 20,000 calls reporting abuse or wrongdoing to a vulnerable adult. 7,500 of those calls were out of the 20,000 were screened out or referred out to other agencies. So the remaining calls, 8,309 were investigated by Community Adult Protective Services, of which 2,439 were substantiated as abuse. In the same year, there were 4,138 allegations of abuse in licensed facilities, with substantiation totaling about 1,562. Now, that doesn't mean that there are 4,000, which is what you'd get when you add those two numbers together, new cases for a public guardian every year in Oregon. First of all, it's not necessarily all the cases being identified anyway, but some of those cases can be dealt with by family members, by friends. In other words, there are other people who can come in and help out and deal with these issues. And there are some people who will have the resources to hire a professional fiduciary on their own. So that does not become an issue for a public guardian program. Let me tell you a little bit about Portland. The Portland program has a budget of a little over $1 million a year. This is completely Multnomah County General Fund money. They serve 165 people. And one of the things about public guardian programs here and throughout the country is when a person becomes a charge of a public guardian program, when they are appointed to be their guardian, this is not a short-term connection. These folks generally do not cease to need the services, and so once you have a client, you have that client as long as they're alive. So the turnover is very slight, and this is true in the other programs in the state that are not, quote, public guardian programs. The demand for services in Multnomah County is tremendous. They have waiting lists. But the reality is that a waiting list doesn't do anything for anybody. When there's a crisis, a waiting list is meaningless. So they have to turn away everybody but the most acutely troubled, exploited, you know, real severe elder abuse cases. And, of course, that's one of the things that public guardian programs deal with is elder abuse, usually family-centered, where the family members are the culprits, and there is no solution within the family group. I do want you to know that there are small community-based programs attempting to serve this population in Oregon City, Washington County, Coos Bay, Medford, and Josephine County. There have been efforts to have programs over the years in many other communities. Lane County has tried several times to get a public guardian and funded, and the county was not willing to pay the money to do that. So I have some case examples for you that I hope will stick with you a little bit, and I will be glad to send you any more of those that you want. I have lots of them, and they're all very heartrending. Now, here's the bottom line. We recognize the circumstances, the financial circumstances that you are coping with, and we have decided, with no pleasure, to defer our request for you to do anything about this problem this session. We are asking that you continue our work, underpaid and unsupported though we may be, for at least another biennium to allow us to put together the best report and the best proposal and the best program that we possibly can, and hope that maybe in a couple of years things will look a little better. We don't see any reason why we should, you know, flesh out everything under the circumstances and then put you to the heartbreaking task of turning us down.
Okay. Yes. Specifically, I'll go back to the Roseburg case where the woman thought her father was being abused. Well, yeah, being abused in the nursing home and not being fed adequately. And the brother had the power of attorney, and the daughter felt that he was trying to get the money that was available. And how would she resolve that?
Leaving out...
even though she may not be... That may not be the way it is, so obviously...
Leaving out the APS aspect. First of all, it has to be investigated. There has to be a basis for it. But let's just assume that this was a genuine bad guy.
Yeah.
We have plenty of them. So what would happen is that in the proposed kind of system we're talking about, the public guardian, if there were no one else to do it, but a family member could do it too, would petition the court for the appointment of a guardian, public or private. That would be the only way that a power of attorney that had been lawfully executed could be set aside. And that would be a decision for the judge in the guardianship proceeding to make whether to honor that or to end it. So that's the solution.
Now,
basically,
that can happen today in that area, Douglas County?
It can happen anywhere as long as there's someone to bring the proceeding. And that is very much one of the sort of ultimate issues here. Who is there to initiate the proceeding to undo a power of attorney that's being abused? And the answer is that APS, who knows about, you know, X percent of these, doesn't do that. They try to find people to do that. They even spend some of their little bit of money. They have a little fund that allows them to do that for a few hundred cases a year. They do not provide a guardian. They don't pay for the guardian. They pay only for the initiation of the legal proceeding. And, of course, if there isn't anybody to serve, you don't initiate the proceeding, if you understand what I'm saying. And that's where our data problem really comes to the, you know, in full bloom. If there's no one to have appointed to take care of me, why go through the process? And even in Multnomah County now, there would be a question about whether a person would get help there, because if they're not in just absolutely horrible circumstances, there's no capacity because the program's full. May I prevail upon you to hear a couple of stories?
I would just like to know a little bit more about how the public guardianship program works in Multnomah County, since that's the only county that has such a program. I understand the process of going to court and getting conservatorship and guardianship and what have you, but how does it work? Does a case manager, who brings it to the program, and how do you identify the individuals to be the guardian, and those kind of logistics?
I will give you a broad overview, because I don't actually do the work, but the public guardian in Portland gets cases from APS, but they also get cases from all sorts of other sources. They get them directly from the police. One of my favorite cases they got from a bank. There are family members who call asking for assistance because there's some kind of crisis. When that occurs, the matter is investigated, again, usually by either the police or APS, depending what the nature of the complaint is, because there is a lot of abuse. There are a lot of abuse issues, and, of course, we want the police to be involved in those and to prosecute if there is a way to prosecute the people who are responsible. The front end of the public guardian program in Portland, and this is true of these little tiny ones, other programs that I mentioned in the rest of the state, have very strong emphasis on diversion, on looking into the case to make sure that there's no other way to deal with it except to get a guardian. If there's a family member who can do something that short of a guardianship, all sorts of different circumstances. But basically what is done is that those people who investigate in the program also look into the question of whether there is someone to serve other than themselves, because they don't, that there is a very strong philosophy in the public guardianship world. It's called the least restrictive alternative. And you always look to see, is there some way, short of the very overwhelming authority that a guardian has, to solve the problem in this case? So that's kind of a quick overview, Senator Winters.
I guess because I've gone through this with a relative, and of course we handled it, you know. But I'm trying to see how a public guardianship would work when it's not a family member or someone else that has gone and asked for conservatorship, and whether or not through the investigation the person has to be certified somewhere in our process that they are demented, and because this is what happened with us, that there was dementia, you had to investigate, have a clinical certification that there was the need for the guardianship.
And do you want me to comment further, Mr. Chairman, on that?
If you have, yeah.
Well, one thing you need to understand is that the people who work in the public guardian's office in Portland are all nationally and state certified fiduciaries. They're people who have fine staff. I worked with them for years. They're very impressive people, very dedicated people. That issue changes in the different parts of the state now where these other programs are. But that's a first piece of it, is that the people who do the work must be qualified, they must have training, they must know what they're doing. And they always look for an alternative short of their ultimate involvement as long-term guardians for people. That's just an article of faith that's very, very strong in these programs and very important.
Okay.
If I could just jump in.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, that, you know, one of the things that I learned from this process is that, you know, we in Oregon don't have an automatic right to counsel for people who are in this kind of situation, you know, where if a determination is there's an investigation that a person might need a guardian, there needs to be a hearing, and that person really needs to be represented by counsel. But we don't have that automatic right here, and so there that does raise a lot of issues related to this notion of least restrictive alternative. Can we be assured that the individual is being presented with the least, the least restrictive alternative and limited guardianship or temporary guardianship or something like that? So this was an issue that we looked at a lot on the committee. We had a representative on the task force from the Disability Rights Oregon, who's certainly helped us to see that perspective. And, you know, I think we have some legislative concepts that we're going to be introducing around this notion, and the judge can say something about that, I think.
Well, you're not going to be pleased to hear this, but the Oregon is one of only, I think, four states in the U.S. that doesn't have some form of publicly supported counsel for some people in the guardianship process. Most states have lawyers for everybody, Washington being a perfect example. Perhaps more significant, although very not that counsel is not important, is that Oregon is the only state in the United States that doesn't have mandatory hearings in every guardianship case. What happens under Oregon law now is that if someone objects, either the protected person themselves, their petition's filed, they're served with a petition, they're actually given what we call the blue form to fill out. It's a very simple form that they can fill out with help or on their own that says, I object to this. It can also say whether they want to have a lawyer. And I'll tell you how we deal with that now. But if they object, or if someone else in the family objects to the proceeding being brought, there is a hearing. If there is no objection, there is no hearing. Now, that's on its surface sounds like, you know, what's the problem with that? There's a problem with that, because if there's no one that cares enough to be providing any oversight in the situation, this may be a situation where people are being drawn into a process that they don't necessarily need to be drawn into. Now, in Multnomah County, Clackamas County, Washington County, and Lane County, for sure, and I think there are some smaller counties that do this too, but I'm positive about those four, and I don't want to misspeak myself. The judges have developed a system of pro bono lawyers to represent folks who need a lawyer. So what we've done, the judges have patched together a system that allows folks, and without regard to whether they're a public guardian candidate in Multnomah County or not, that provides lawyers, and they all, they're wonderful lawyers who are very highly qualified elder law practitioners that represent these people. This is a very, very big issue, because if you don't have a process to make sure you're going down the right road, what we're doing is drawing people into a very restrictive world where somebody else gets to decide where they live, who they can see, where they can go. I mean, their lives are very much under the control of another human being.
Okay, there are two connections that I'm not sure are really being made. I just found out last week that our Senate president started his career as a legal aid attorney, and he was honored at an event, and part of the information was that the private attorneys helped fund the legal aid. I work very closely with legal aid in Lane County, Tim Baxter. If I ran across a case like this, he would be the first person I would call, and then he would represent them. So there is a legal aid thing. Now, the other connection that I'm not sure exists is with ombudsman persons, and I would appreciate it if you would invite Mary Jaeger to one of your meetings someday.
She's on the committee.
Oh, you are on it. Okay, okay. Well, then, but see, I don't know. I'm not sure what connections there are. There have been in the past with the ombudsman person starting the ball rolling rather than that's a natural, right? No?
I don't know. I certainly haven't knowingly seen it.
Well, okay. Senator Winters.
Well, I would agree with Judge Wells. I haven't seen it either, and the ombudsman's role in dealing with long-term systems may come across a need, but I would agree that this is an independent outside service that deals with a specific court and legal process of an individual. And I just from going through this process with my son and his great aunt, and it's a lot more complicated than I think most people realize. And it's everything from certifying that the individual, first determining that the person needed some assistance, then determining what's the process to get there, and it can be a very lengthy process going through both the court and all the other family members and getting the certification, and then where will the person live? You're right, it's a lot involved in it, and if you have any resources, mm-hmm. that further the fiduciary responsibility then comes into play. I don't see that as the ombudsman piece.
Yeah,
I do agree that with the independent oversight.
I'm not suggesting the ombudsman person do anything but notify. They, in many cases, are the first ones to be aware there is abuse going on. So it seems to me that should be part of their arsenal of, this is something that needs to be turned over to...
Absolutely. And let me tell you... I'll give you a little quick insight. Several months ago, Ms. Jaeger invited me to speak to a training session for the statewide ombudsman program. And it was just a little workshop, and there were maybe 50, 60 people who chose to come and hear from a judge and a lawyer about guardianship, etc. And I was, first of all, extremely impressed with the people. But the questions they had will kind of maybe give you a little window into what you're talking about. They wanted to know, does the judge always do what the court visitor says to do in a case? And I don't know if you all know what a court visitor is, but in every adult guardianship in Oregon, there is supposed to be a court visitor appointed by the court to investigate, to determine whether there is, in fact, a basis for the guardianship and whether the person who is nominated as guardian is appropriate to serve. So they have lots and lots of questions about the legal process. It's my sense that they see themselves as being outside of the process, to some degree being unable to influence, and asking lots of questions about how they might be able to influence. And we talked about that, and Mary and I have talked about that since, about how that could be developed. But at this point, Oh, for instance, one of the things I think I had the most questions about is guardians of people in care facilities who won't let members of the protected person's family come see them for whatever reason. And this is usually family dynamic stuff, you know, ugly stuff. But, you know, what can we do when some poor soul wants to see their kid or their mother or whatever it is, and they're not being permitted to do it? So can I give you
one? Yeah, I'm sorry. No. That was exactly the case in Roseburg. The woman said that she is being denied visiting her father, who is dying of starvation. And the response was, she can visit him, but not during mealtime. Now, that's a rule of that particular nursing home, and I don't know if that makes sense or not, because she said people don't eat, they visit. Well, that doesn't make sense to me. And so that was her concern, is that she was being denied access to her father by her uncle. And I don't know how, you know, they resolved that. The ombudsman said, no, there wasn't abuse. And I suggested taking a look at how to get the guardianship. Okay.
A couple of examples. These are from SPD. This is not from Multnomah County, because the Multnomah County examples are all have good outcomes. These don't. This is a 74-year-old woman who's not doing very well. She asks strangers if they are people that she lives with. She needs to be reminded to eat. She has four sons. One of them is developmentally delayed and has always lived with her. And he kind of took care of her for a long time, even though he had his challenges. He was able to get her meals. One of her other sons had her take out a line of credit on her house for $60,000 and spend it all in less than a year of gambling. Then he moved away. She lost her home as a result of this to foreclosure. And she and her disabled son lived in a substandard trailer in horrible condition, with, you know, as a fire hazard and leaky. And she was very confused. Then her two more sons moved in, took over, and kept she and her disabled son from using any of the house except their own bedrooms. She fled to the neighbors when these guys got drunk. And apparently APS got involved. One of the sons was belligerent and threatened her and the neighbors. They didn't want her to be protected by anybody, and they didn't want her on Medicare. APS got involved. They had to escort this lady away from the premises with the help of the police. There was no one to act as a guardian. There was no one to do it. And the local AAA office in the town involved eventually found someone willing to serve on a pro bono basis as a guardian, and she was moved into an adult foster home. This is a very, very typical story. There are zillions of them. Another one involves a guy who was whose house burned down. He was 86 years old. He got lung damage from the fire. He was in the house when it happened. He there was meth being produced on the premises, so that made his lung damage more severe. He was placed in an adult foster home after he was discharged from the hospital. His son, the one we're already fond of here, came to visit him for lunch. But what it turned out was that he had gathered up his dad's Social Security and pension checks that had accumulated while he was in the hospital, had his father sign off on the checks, dropped him back at the adult foster home, didn't even get him lunch, and took his money. And in that case, there was no one to serve as a guardian. They could find no one to help this man. So he continues to be vulnerable to this same behavior indefinitely.
Mike, what kind of legislative solution do you have for this?
Well, yes, we're thinking of selling some valuable state property to fund this. I won't tell you what it is. We have a couple of concepts related to the mandatory hearing and the right to counsel that's coming out, and then another concept that's just, you know, being refined now, that would essentially keep this process going and to keep the work going on creating an ongoing commission on public guardians that would not only help to develop the model for the eventual program, but also look at setting standards for guardians things that really we have an immediate need for, even if we don't have a program in place. And I would add one thing. You know, one of the things that I found really intriguing about this process was learning from, we have a person on the task force who's an administrator at the state hospital, that there are people in institutional care at the state hospital who could be in community-based care, but for the lack of a guardian. And, you know, these are people who could be in less restrictive settings, these people who are in the state hospital for civil commitments. They could be in community-based care, eligible for Medicaid funding, you know, as opposed to being in the state hospital where it's all on the state dime. But they have no guardian to oversee that transition and to be responsible for them. There's a chance that they will if they are moving to Multnomah County, but in other parts of the state, they're not going to have that kind of guardian, or there's not going to be that kind of guarantee of a guardian. So, you know, I think that the long-range vision of the task force, you know, is that we have some kind of program that has, a statewide focus to it that can partner with local government, with counties, with AAAs, et cetera, to coordinate activity around the state so that people, everywhere in the junction cities as well as, the Portlands have access to a guardian.
Okay. This is a county-funded program generally then?
Yes.
Are you working with the Association of Oregon Counties?
Mm-hmm.
You are. Yeah.
I was going to ask, thank you, yeah. Mr. Chair, but, you know, could the role of a case manager, because when you mentioned State Hospital and others, and also I want to piggyback on the good chair's comment about legal aid services and whether or not they were part of your discussion and your group when we talk about some of the representing the individual and what have you. So there may be... I'm just looking at resources now.
I know, yeah. Mr. Chairman, legal aid resources in this state are so modest as to be excruciating. There is very little help in. I'm not familiar with legal aid programs outside of the metropolitan area. There is very little effort being. We cannot get lawyers to represent people on probate proceedings. From the legal aid programs in the metropolitan area. They don't. It's not that they're unwilling, it's that they don't have the resources. They are doing almost exclusively family abuse cases,
okay.
Domestic violence cases,
and
improperly so.
Have you at all looked at funding resources at all? I mean, like, assisted living, long-term care, residential. I know people are going to panic. But people who are where we find many of the problems, and I don't know, are they mainly those who are in their own homes, or are they in assisted living? Are they in long-term care? Are they?
Yeah, I understand the question, Mr. Chairman, Senator Anderson, Melissa Anderson. We don't know who are where the. This data problem is such a chicken
problem.
And an egg issue. In some states, in some of the national literature, it's assertive, and it shocked me, and I'm sure it shocked Mary when it was said that most of the people we're talking about are in institutional settings. It's certainly not my experience in Portland. Au contraire.
Okay.
Yeah. But, again, generalizing on a little tiny bit of information is such a dangerous thing.
Mm-hmm. And, Chair Morissette and Senator Miles Anderson, in response to the idea about seeking alternative financial sources, some of the states have been able to modify their Medicaid waivers to get some of the Medicaid payments directed to support a guardian, guardian services. And that's something that we're probably going to recommend this state look at as well. you know, anytime you modify a Medicaid waiver, it gets very complicated and people have vested interests, et cetera. But it seems so critical that people have access to these kinds of services that it seems like that it should be a part of our waiver.
Other states do that.
They do.
Washington.
Well, it's a model.
What comes out of that pot in one place
takes away.
Away from someplace else. So don't forget that. I mean, it's not like it's an expansion of what's in the pot. That's the point.
Well, that's right. Okay, so then you have to prioritize, and someone has to make that critical judgment that this is a very important thing, and we will use some resources to do that. So, it's always a tough decision.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, we are in touch with Senator Wyden's office. He has a long background in this field. We are seeking his assistance, help, anything we can get. Money, obviously, would be the ultimate goal, but any kind of guidance that we can get at the national level, that's what's going on. And there, part of health care reform included the Elder Justice Act, and there's money for the Elder Justice Act. Supposedly, we have yet to see any regs on what the money's for, but I assure you we are keeping our eye out for anything that's out there that can help.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, now we are going to hear the presentation from the Governor's Commission on Senior Services, Patty Probst and Charles Richards. Would you come up, please? Sorry for the delay, but...
That's quite all right, because it fits right in with my first statement.
Good. You've got the answers to these very difficult problems that we're dealing with.
I think we created the problem.
Oh, you created...
Yes.
Oh, okay. I won't ask you how, but...
Anyway, thank you very much for having us come today, and we apologize for no written testimony. We were not aware of this until last night, very late.
Oh.
So if you wish, we can provide you with something later today.
Well...
Anyway,
we'll invite you back in December.
Okay.
If you like that.
Yeah.
We'll know better next time. We're very happy to be here because of what has gone on before with Mary Jaeger's comments and with the presentation that was just done.
Excuse me. Introduce yourself.
Oh, I'm Patty Probst, and I'm a member of the Governor's Commission on Senior Services.
I'm Charles Richards. I'm also a member of the Governor's Commission on Seniors.
Good. Thank you. Go ahead, Patty.
Okay. One of the things that we did 2 years ago as a commission was to go throughout the state and meet with the local care providers, the local citizens, trying to determine what they thought the issues and needs of seniors were. We visited with people in Astoria, Ontario, Medford, and Clackamas County, kind of the Portland metro area. And there were several things that really stood out, and one of them was the guardianship. And so we started to work on that. We are fortunate to have a retired lawyer as one of our commission members who worked with the Multnomah County guardianship program. And it's gone forward and was passed by the legislators. And then now you know the story of where it is right now. And we are very interested in seeing that it does get some funding so that it can move forward, because it is a very great need for seniors and the disabled. One of the other things that we worked with was affordable housing for seniors. This is real need, because most of them are on fixed incomes, low income, and we several years ago worked with the manufactured home industry, and people were being evicted on very short notice, and it was really kind of a drier situation, and there was some measures that were put in place to prevent that from happening. Another thing that we did was to, we found out through the transportation committee that we had at the time that there was new liability insurance requirement that was going to be placed on people who are transportation providers for seniors and people with disabilities, that would have caused their insurance to go
skyrocketing to the point where they were going to have to close. Hmm. And so we did initiate some action to alert the Office of Primary Responsibility in the state to see if this could be rescinded, and I believe it was taken care of. And then also we're very involved with wanting to make sure that Oregon Project Independence continues because of the need of the seniors for that. It gives them such dignity, yes, and independence to be able to stay in their own homes, and it costs the state a lot less than putting them in facilities. And we need those savings right now with what is going on. One of the other things that we have done is to support reductions in state in proposed automobile registrations and license fees that would affect seniors also. Now, just a couple of weeks ago, there was a report that came out from DHS in regards to the suicide rates in the state of Oregon. And Lisa Millett, who was the prime investigator of the research, had come to the commission after one report was done about five years previous. And as a result of that previous report, there was a plan developed to help with reduction of the suicide rate. And the highest rate is amongst older gentlemen, like 85 and older, and it occurs in Curry County. We're not sure exactly why, but anyway, they end up using a firearm to kill themselves with. So what we are doing, in fact, tomorrow we have the person who's the head of the Department for Senior Mental Health coming to talk to us, and this is one of the issues that we want to bring up with him, is why this plan hasn't been implemented. We understand the budget constraints, but there might be something that we could possibly do to help that. So we're mostly in.
Sure. Yeah. Just to respond on that, I actually know a gentleman who committed a suicide, and he was 85 plus. But it was a very conscious and rational decision. His body had deteriorated such. We do have the assisted suicide here in Oregon, but he knew that once he went to the doctor, his condition was such that he could not live any longer. He did not want to go into an assisted living. He was very aware that his family could not take care of him. He knew that if he got into the system, it would cost a horrendous amount of money. He did not want that to happen. So he was very rational. He didn't think it was a bad thing to do. He wanted peace. He was ready to go. He had lived a good life. And this is the way and it was the easiest way, he thought, to end his life. And it wasn't to him, it wasn't a terrible thing. So I just want to share that, because there is a different perspective when you get to be over 85 and your quality of life has just deteriorated horrendously.
Thanks for sharing that, because that's very true. And different people have different attitudes on the end of their lives. And we do have the assisted program, but that is something that is really only mostly done when someone has a terminal illness like cancer or heart failure, that sort of thing. And depending upon what this gentleman's circumstances were with his physical health, he probably had determined that it was not appropriate to use. But it's a real balancing act sometimes. Mm-hmm. And of course, you have to take into consideration the person's own desires and wishes for their end of life. So it's a real sticky issue sometimes. But one of the other things, too, that we are interested in is looking at tax expenditures, as that whole thing as a possible source of funding. We have someone coming tomorrow also to talk to us about that. So we're very active in identifying what the seniors' needs and issues are, and then advocating as
we try to find champions in the various sections of the, like Senator Marceret is our champion for the Senate, and I think Michael Denbrow has become our champion for the representative, House of Representatives. He's been very helpful with all of that going on with the guardianship. And we hope that that does become a real fact eventually.
Now, Jeff Brandon?
Yes, Jeff Brandon is our member of the commission that's been involved with that from the very beginning.
He's the former deputy public guardian and conservator for Multnomah.
Yes.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And he's currently working with the task force. I'm going to turn this over to Charles.
Well, I'm the other side of the coin. First of all, as a personal citizen of Oregon, I would like to thank Chairman Morissette and the e-boards both for doing things for seniors that have been above and beyond the call of duty. We really appreciate all that work you've done, and the e-board at a time that they really came through for us and helped us out when we really needed it. As all the state agencies, we did take the 50% hit on our staffing, and it was very painful. But our organization's in the kind of a midst of a changeover. We've had some wonderfully fine people who have had years and years of experience. Now they've got a bunch of green people like myself coming in there. And one thing, we are a little bit frustrated. We want to do more because we are the conduit for the people of Oregon to get to government, to be respected, and to get the kind of care and services they need. And what we realize when you go there is how many subjects there are to talk about, everything from medical marijuana all the way through all the various issues that come up for seniors. The transportation issue and all these issues have been very important. But what we find is we're frustrated because we can't do more. And so in the upcoming session, the biennium we're coming into, we've made the decision to go over to a more legislative stance and work with the legislatures as much as we can. We think it's time to stop all the divisions that have broken us up for so long and actually get to work. We all are from a generation that grew up where the work ethic was really important, and we have the abilities and we have the people who can do things to help the state of Oregon, and that's what we plan to do. So I know that's kind of a soapbox, but that's exactly the way we feel, because we are a bit frustrated with the cuts that we haven't been able to do quite as much as we'd like, but we will be there, and we will be sticking the needles in people if we think it's necessary.
Well, I think it's great, and one of the issues that came up a couple of years ago, there's a physician. Well, whether or not seniors had access to Medicare, because the reimbursement rate was not very good, and so that led to some supplemental programs that doctors can, if you have a supplemental health program, then. But, and that's an issue because, you know, even primary care physicians, a lot of people are not going into that field because they make more money doing other things, specializing. So I think you guys are very, very important to, you know, understanding the problems and going out into the communities and then coming to the legislature and so on. So it's a critical role.
Well, I had a personal thing happen to me. I got a supplemental plan when I was turned 65. I spent entire year in Marion County trying to find a doctor that would accept it, and there never was accepted. You're forced into group situations rather than that. And I'm also on the National Silver-Haired Congress, and the primary care physician thing is a real, real chaotic situation. You don't realize it, that there are no good old doctors back there that, you know, that you can remember as a kid. There are no, those people aren't there. They've all turned to specialism, and it's a real problem because a lot of people just need, for simple things, it's not the big major issues.
Yeah.
It's just if you get an infection or something and you have to go, and why should you have to go to an emergency care office? I was in emergency care for 3 hours. The bill was $2,472. I paid $15 for two Tylenol. I mean, these are kind of things that are, there's something wrong with this situation, and I think that's one of the things we can look into. And I'm really happy to, I can't tell you how excited I am to work with a senior.
Now, the supplemental insurance that you then got solved, you have a...
Yeah, I have. I had to go. I went with a group, one of the group situations, and that I do have a doctor now. But I'm also covered by VA because I'm a disabled vet.
Yeah.
One of the things that has happened is that primary care physicians are not, many of them are not accepting patients, new patients with Medicare.
Absolutely.
And that's kind of a nationwide problem, and it can be very devastating.
Well, that's where I think the supplemental insurance is important, because the reimbursement rate is not that good. Now, whether or not even with the supplemental they don't accept them, but I know that in Plain County, it's LIPA, Lynn Independent Physicians Association. You have a counterpart in Marion County, and that's a physician organization. And they provide supplemental care in Lane County. It's Trillium. I don't know what it is in Marion County, but those associations will provide primary care docs if you have supplemental insurance, for the most part.
Yeah. But we're hoping with the elections that are coming up that whoever is elected in the state of Oregon, that we can be a closer. It's kind of strange to work for an organization called the Governor's Commission and not actually have the governor involved more. I think that's a responsibility of that governor, whoever he is, to bring that back so it really means something to be in a Governor's Commission. That's personal.
One of the other things that we've also been doing is watching what's been going on with the Oregon Health Authority, and want to make sure that they know about seniors and chronic illness. And I know that they're talking about starting some pilots in regards to the primary patient-centered care models. So that'll be interesting to follow that and see what happens with that, because that's where a lot of seniors will end up.
Mr. Chair, yeah, community-based health care is, and our medical home model, so to speak, is supposed to bring in all those with care issues, and that includes the seniors. And I'm cautiously optimistic that everyone is going to be included in that.
That it's going to happen.
Well, Senator Montes Anderson's committee... Are we going to be dealing with that?
Yeah.
Some of those issues today. I think Oregon has always been on the forefront of providing trying to provide affordable. You know, Dr. Kitzhoffer, when he was governor, created the Oregon Health Plan, which was very, very effective, and so on. I'm hoping that we are enough of a model to get some federal funding to do what we're doing, because, you know, we both are talking about exchanges. We're both talking about some of the same things. And so hopefully we can receive some federal dollars to do what we're planning to do. And the medical home is, if I can ever figure that out. The primary care doc who is ahead of the medical home wants to know who's going to pay him for his time. So, anyway, it's got some interesting complications. Any other questions, comments? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Update on... we're going to be dealing with a worker influenza vaccine workshop. A whole bunch of people. Would you all come up?
Well, the first
Andy
panel.
Easton.
No. Oh. The first panel is.
Oh, the first panel.
Right.
Okay. Dr. Cieslak, Catherine,
and Sean.
And Sean. Okay. I guess I would like to say that I appreciate the work that has been done. It's not as simple as just passing a mandatory bill, which we could do, which we might end up doing. Senator Montes Anderson has even a draft that she's hiding. No, we don't want to go that route. I mean, the hearings that we had, I think you know, people came and said, gee, this is a lot to ask of us. We're not really ready for that. We don't even know who, you know, who the health care workers are. We don't have a, you know, anyone who deals with, you know, the doc. The one group not included in there are the physicians, the people who work in dentist's office. I mentioned this to my dentist, and he was highly insulted that. He said, well, yeah, but we wear masks, and so we don't breathe flu germs on people. What about the doctor's office and clinics and so on? So we're making headway. One of the big problems is identification and then the technology to make it possible to make the reports in a timely fashion and to get input from people about why they don't want to have vaccine. And there are a variety of reasons, and some of them are religious-based, but... in your report, you say there has to be a certain level before it's about 50%. It should be up to 80-90% before it's effective. So with that, who wants to go first?
Chair Morissette and committee, my name is Catherine Bradley. I'm the administrator for the Office of Family Health. What I'd like to do is just give you a brief update of the work we've been doing over the last couple of months. And then we have Sean Colmer here from Oregon Health Policy and Research that will give the results of the survey that was done of healthcare workers. And then Dr. Paul Cieslak, who is our medical director for the immunization program, is also here and can provide you with an update of the current flu season. It's not the pending one. It's the current one. I do want to say we appreciate all the support that we have received and the partnership from all of our partners that have been a part of this conversation. It has been a very good conversation that we've had, I think, in terms of trying to look about where we can move forward. There's a very strong commitment to the importance of immunization of healthcare workers. There's also a strong commitment to try and explore as many voluntary approaches as we possibly can. We do have an ability now to have a baseline data approach through Oregon Health Policy and Research that will be reported on. We also have a survey process that we are going to be using with healthcare worker opinions that we have developed, which is a SurveyMonkey process, and we have a number of organizations that are going to step forward and use it to share with their workers so that we can be better tuned to what the issues are and then figure out what the right kind of marketing and education is to address that. We've got a commitment to flu vaccine campaigns and flu vaccine education through many of our partners. And an agreement to monitor this voluntary effort with quarterly meetings and updates to sort of see how this is moving forward. We're talking about setting goals in terms of what the expectation might be in terms of where we're trying to move so that we can really measure the effectiveness of the education and our approaches. So we've been very pleased with the work and the partnership across the work groups. We are hopeful that we will have more members of both the hospital and long-term care community participate. We're identifying ways that we are able to go out maybe and go to some of their programs and some of their meetings to bring these issues also to bear with them. And we've got some great examples through some of the associations and through some of the work, for instance, with Providence Hospital and some legacy hospital and some of our larger hospitals, which then have information that we believe can be shared and can be duplicated in different ways. And the state will function as a website and host for much of that. So that provides you with sort of a brief overview of where we are currently, and perhaps Sean can give you an overview of the results of the survey.
Thank you, Catherine. Chair Morissette, members of the committee, for the record, Sean Colmer, Deputy Administrator of the Office of Health Policy and Research in the Oregon Health Authority. Thank you for having us today. We're glad that we can support some of this committee work with some of the reporting programs that we're in charge of, namely the Healthcare Acquired Infections Reporting Program. The slide deck in front of you has a couple of slides that, one, give you a brief background of what the survey is, and then talks about our focus on hospitals for this first round, and then gives you a little sense of what it looks like in Oregon hospitals, and we think it gives a pretty good sense for Oregon hospitals only. So on slide 3, what you'll see is this survey was developed through looking at what the feds do at CDC and what some national standards are, also in collaboration with Oregon stakeholders, with our Healthcare Acquired Infection Advisory Committee. So those include members of the infection control community, from hospitals, from surgery centers, nurses. So we feel like we had a broad participation in developing sort of our survey. The survey went out earlier this spring and collected information about the last flu season. So we came in at the tail end of the flu season. The survey went to human resource directors because that's where employee health happens. So that's where usually the records live in hospitals about who was vaccinated and who wasn't. And we also sent out notices to our infection control community at those hospitals. We got one survey back per hospital, and we got a survey back from every hospital but one. So we feel like this is a pretty good look inside Oregon hospitals.
Now, hospitals are required to keep that data, is that right, or not?
Chair Moore said, I think what you'll find is most of them do.
Okay.
I can't speak of whether they're required or not, but most of them do.
Okay. The statute says that that can being vaccinated cannot be a condition of employment. So that's, but they don't have to keep it, but they, it's a good, but most of them do keep it.
Chair Moore said, this is a good good segue into slide six in your deck. And what that shows is that hospitals have some really good internal processes for collecting that information, both whether people are getting vaccinated and also whether people are declining and whatever reason they're declining for. So I think that there's been tremendous effort in the hospital community to sort of engage their employees and employees in that broad sense, not just physicians or nurses, but secretaries, janitors, food staff, cafeteria staff, folks who have contact with patients. Mm-hmm. There's at least a fairly decent system in most hospitals. Can't say they're comparable, but hospitals feel at least comfortable that they have information about most of their healthcare workers in sort of that broad sense. So slide six gives you some sense of about three quarters of the hospitals can cover the most broad categories of healthcare workers. So again, a definition that goes beyond direct line providers. And then about a quarter of hospitals can get about 20% of those categories. So my sense is they get the direct providers really well, and it's those sort of ancillary employees that they have trouble keeping track of. So that's sort of our sense from the data that we've collected. On slide seven, you'll see where hospitals are. So you'll see, on average, 62% of healthcare workers inside hospitals are vaccinated, and this is seasonal flu. This is an H1N1. But as you can see on the bar charts, the middle one and the far right one, there's extreme variation in how many are being vaccinated. So as you can see, one hospital had only a quarter of their healthcare workers vaccinated, and one facility had 88% vaccinated. So if you're talking about getting facilities and Oregon to a threshold that our public health professionals believe is effective, there is a lot of work that needs to be done in some facilities. On slide seven speaks to Chair Morissette about some of the issues you mentioned about collection of information. Again, most hospitals are collecting not only if they're vaccinating someone, but if they're declining. Again, there's a lot of variation between how that information is collected, but all in all, they're saying a decline. Whether there's the detail underneath of why that decline is there is a little up in the air, but there is some of that information there, and we try to collect that in the survey that we have. On slide nine, I think this directly supports, and we hope it supports, the work that Catherine and the Public Health Division and their partners are going to continue to work on, giving some examples of some best practices and how facilities are currently approaching vaccinating healthcare workers. So as you can see, sort of those vaccination fairs, peer vaccinators are sort of the most popular ways that they're sort of getting vaccination to their workers. But this is only a snapshot of some of the things that are out there. And again, looking at the hospital that has the 88% or those hospitals that are really doing well, what are they doing to help other facilities sort of get to that benchmark that I think that people want to get to? Chair Morissette, members of the committee, that's all I have, but I'd be more than happy to answer any questions that you have now or later.
Paul, do you want to go ahead and we'll come maybe some questions?
Chair Morissette, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Dr. Paul Cieslak, Medical Director for the Immunization for the Oregon Health Authority. I'm basically just here to answer any questions you might have about influenza or its vaccination. As Catherine Bradley alluded to, the current flu season is underway. We have one confirmed case in Oregon, just confirmed a couple of days ago. So the kids go back to school and influenza comes back.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
So at this point in time, it looks like you want to continue to work with hospitals and surgery centers, et cetera, to get more information. Are you wanting to have recommendations for legislation? Could you let us know what your views are on that?
Chair Morissette and Senator Mona Sanderson, thank you. We at this time are trying to explore as many voluntary approaches as we can. We do have some survey approaches. The work that has come from Oregon Health Policy Research is a good baseline. We're looking at some modifications to the survey for next year for a better understanding of declination. The question that we are still most concerned about is the why. Why are people declining? Why are they not pursuing it? And where might we use some of our public health knowledge and education to really identify and target going after some of the myths and misperceptions. So we've got additional survey work that we believe is possible. We've got some very strong partners that are with us and several that are going to speak in addition after this. So we're trying to explore a voluntary approach and would like the opportunity to report back on an ongoing effort to have that accountability to this work, to this group.
Thank you.
The reason that we did not proceed with the bill that we had last time, there were a couple of reasons. One is because I realized that you already had a lot of authority to do certain things, and I'm not sure what the limits of that are, and that's something that if you are able to address right now, that would be good. What can you do, and what do you not have the authority to do? Identification of workers, healthcare workers, you've made a lot of progress on that. And then the other thing is doctors. Who is there a doctor reporting on your committee? Do you have a physician that represents?
Right. Chair Morissette, we do have the Oregon Medical Association part of this conversation
They need to. The local doctors, physicians, and clinics, and so on, are the front line. Pharmacies, they give they give the vaccine. Do they take the vaccine themselves? So there's another group, the pharmacists. Other states, have you looked at what other states are doing?
Chair Morissette, there are a couple of states that New York comes to mind. That have mandated influenza vaccination of healthcare providers. I think it's too early to tell how that's going to work because last season was such an aberrant season with the H1N1 pandemic coming in and there being insufficient supplies of vaccines. So immediately they had to employ the administrative step of exempt, essentially waiving the requirement that they had just instituted. So it's a little too early to tell how that's working out.
Okay, if the state of Oregon passed a mandatory vaccination law, would that trump or we probably have to change the ORS that says that cannot be a condition of employment because that would be a competing issue. And I think the Nurses Association put that in at some point that it cannot be, but mandating would be the last resort, but I think it's important because, as you acknowledge, there are a certain number of people who die from from flu who should be protected from it. And besides, hospitals, it's very difficult in a hospital to keep infections down as it is and to have the flu vaccine, bugs on top of it.
I have a mortality question. Do we get more deaths from flu or from pneumonia in the hospital?
Chair Morissette, Senator Winters, I think I don't know the answer to the question. Typically, when we're measuring the impact of influenza, you find that other causes of pneumonia go up at the same time, and we think that the two operate together. So to some degree, at least, influenza is responsible for some fraction of deaths from pneumonia, and it's very difficult to tease out. When the CDC does studies of how many people die of influenza, they kind of lump them together as pneumonia and influenza that occurs when flu is circulating. So there is some some pneumonia that occurs in the summertime when flu is not circulating, and they look at excess deaths from pneumonia and influenza when influenza is circulating, and they infer that those are caused by influenza. And that number, the most recent guesstimate from CDC, is 23,000 per year on average, with a lot of year-to-year variability, and that would translate to about 350 per year in Oregon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We went through this report fairly quickly, and I wasn't clear if you touched on it or not. Well, first of all, I'm actually surprised that the rates aren't a bit higher across the board. I'm wondering, is the major issue that healthcare workers are declining, and it's being offered and they're declining, or it's just an issue of convenience, although it seems to me like it's a fairly convenient thing. It has been convenient for me, but...
Chair Morissette, Senator Edwards, in our results for hospitals, sort of declining accounts are about 1% of the issue. So it seems like the offers are there, and people are declining them, or they're signing declinations that say, I'm not doing it for X, Y, and Z reason. So in our data, it doesn't seem to be a big issue. So it seems like the offers are being made, but I'm not sure to what degree at a particular hospital that's an issue.
So to clarify, the offers are being made, but declining vaccination is the major reason why rates aren't higher? Or I didn't understand what you just said.
Chair Morissette, Senator Edwards, from our data, it seems like hospitals are putting their best foot forward to do vaccinations. And I think it's become a personal decision about whether people are doing it or not and whether they see the value in it or not. But I hesitate to make that broad stroke because there are some facilities that have tremendous rates. So they're doing something differently there that isn't happening in all facilities.
Just a follow-up comment. I guess it's a question. Are hospitals... are they getting the vaccination soon enough? And the reason I ask is I was traveling out of the country here recently, and when I went to the hospital to have any vaccinations that I would need, I asked about the flu vaccination. They said, well, we're not going to get that until October. And so I went to Walgreens, and they had it in August. And I said, this is this year's? And they said, yeah, this is this year's, and it's H1N1, and it's this year's. I said, well, local hospital isn't going to have this until October, they tell me. I said, well, yeah, but we have more purchasing power, and we have it now. So,
okay. Chair Morissette, Senator Edwards, now is about the time when the vaccine is really starting to roll out, and it doesn't hit the market or it doesn't hit the hospitals institutions all at once. So they're right at this particular time of year, and probably well into December, you're going to find that some places have it and some places don't. What the hospitals will do is they'll wait to get their shipment, and then they'll start holding flu clinics and rolling the carts down through the wards and offering vaccine to healthcare workers. But my guess is that at this point in the year, some of them have it, some of them don't. But the supply is expected to be robust this year. Vaccine manufacturers are going to be producing about 140 million doses. That's well over anything they've ever produced before, and there's going to be plenty of it around in time for the flu season, which generally in Oregon doesn't really kick in until December. So we advise people get it as soon as you can, but if it comes in November, December, it's probably going to be in plenty of time to meet the peak of the flu season.
Okay, the declination, CDC has a form that I think is very good because it lists all the compelling reasons why you should have the vaccine, and if you choose not to take it, you sign it. Well, to me, that is a invitation for a lawsuit. If, and I don't know where the hospitals are on that, but, you know, if you can trace the catching of the flu from a particular person and the a staff person, and, the, and there's a death involved. I'm sure there are some lawyers that would love to jump on that and say, hey, they should have known that this is a contagious disease. You're dealing with the most vulnerable people who are in ill health to start with, and because you are negligent in having your vaccine, you had an opportunity to take it, and here you signed a form saying you don't want it. Well, you're going to be sued. And so I think the CDC form is a good form because it lays the groundwork for legal recourse, liability. Think of it as liability insurance. Go ahead.
Chair Morissette, perhaps I should preface my comment with, warning doctor addressing legal issue. But from an epidemiologic perspective, it is difficult to trace
right.
a case of influenza to the source of the influenza. When flu is around, it's around. Lots of people have it. Difficult to pinpoint the source of your influenza.
Doctor, isn't it like the airplane? It's airborne, and it's in this building, and it's everywhere.
Chair Morissette, Senator Winters, usually it's not everywhere. It we don't think most of it's transmitted by the airborne route. It's transmitted by this kind of contact at this level. But there's plenty of people you come in contact with every day. You don't
on the
know
airplane.
Whether they wash their hands before shaking hands with you. And there's plenty of places to get it that you don't even know where you're getting it.
So it's not just necessarily in the medical facilities. That's my point. Mm-hmm. That it's not just in the hospital. It's not just in the clinics. You know, you can find it in other parts of our environment.
That's correct. Yeah, the reason we worry about medical settings is because, you know, medical settings do attract sick people. That's where sick people go. And in medical settings, you have a lot of highly vulnerable people, people with immune system compromise and chronic disease who can't afford an infection like influenza on top of whatever else they have. And that's why we do fret more about medical settings.
Okay.
Chair Morissette, Senator Winters, I just want to add as well that although our first round of our survey work is focused on hospitals, we do intend to do this similar work for nursing homes and ambulatory surgery centers to sort of making sure that we're trying to get to as many healthcare facilities as we can, knowing full well that there's influenza running around everywhere, including as I'm thinking about my kids in school right now.
Okay. Thank you very much. And again, yeah, go ahead. Thank you. We have another panel. Andy Easton, would you come up, please, and Linda Enos. Again, I really appreciate the work that you've been doing, and this is much better, I think, if we have the voluntary effort with, and if you need legislation or if we feel that legislation is required after you have gone through some of these steps, that would be, I think, the best way of doing it, because you're on the right track, and so hopefully that will. So, who wants to go first?
Sure. Good morning. I'm Andy Easton, Director of Advocacy for the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, and I'm here today for Tom Holt, who ironically is home ill with flu-like symptoms.
Oh, I'm glad he couldn't be here today.
But we wanted to reassure the hospital's commitment to educating our healthcare providers about the importance of flu vaccination. As healthcare organizations, we believe that it is our responsibility to take a leadership role in this education process. In talking to individuals, for whatever reason, may have declined the flu shot in the past. We also believe it's reasonable for patients and consumers to have the assumption that when they come in contact with our healthcare provider that they will not be put at risk of contracting the flu. So with that, I would answer any questions you may have, as limited knowledge as I may have on this issue, because Tom is our expert on this issue.
Questions? Okay. We may come back to you.
Okay. Chair Morissette, members of the committee, good morning. My name's Linda Enos. I'm from the Oregon Nurses Association. I'm an occupational health nurse by profession, and I believe you have testimony that has been passed to you. The Oregon Nurses Association, or ONA, supports efforts to increase vaccination rates for seasonal flu, influenza, in healthcare workers. We have and will continue to actively participate in a concerted and coordinated voluntary effort to achieve this goal, including looking at the knowledge, attitudes, and beliefs of healthcare workers around vaccination and framing future interventions such as targeted education and policy. We have data to support that targeted education and communication campaigns can have an impact. From September 2009 last year, for about 5 months, we worked on an ongoing basis to educate our members at ONA to receive H1N1 immunization of flu vaccine and seasonal flu vaccination. We conducted a survey between January and May in 2010 of this year, and we wanted to know the experience of direct care registered nurses during H1N1 pandemic. So one section of the questions we asked was related to vaccination. Of the 253 nurses and 3 student nurses who responded to the survey, 70% were vaccinated for H1N1. If we consider that vaccination wasn't readily available until mid-fall, I think that's a pretty good number. We'd like to believe that some of our education communication efforts had something to do with that, as well as what we've done in the state in public health. I would like to address Senator Edwards' comment or question earlier about access and declination. When I looked at the data for the reason why nurses did decline the vaccine, and we had 27 responses, it's small, but it does indicate some reasons why they may not do this. Over a quarter, it was medical religious reasons, and then another quarter were because they had been sick and believed that they'd had the H1N1 flu already. About 50% gave other varying reasons, and one of them was access to the vaccine. And if we look at the data that was just presented, a hospital where there's an uptake of vaccination of 27%, I can't believe that 70% are declining. Something else is going on there, and it may be that they don't have a good program, resources to provide a good program for vaccination. And we do hear from members and on this survey that access is important. So if the flu vaccine is available on shift in a unit, we're going to have better uptake, especially with our nurses. However, going forward, if legislation is pursued going forward that supports mandatory vaccination of healthcare workers in Oregon, ONA would support policy only if the criteria described in the testimony I've supplied today are met. Thank you for your time today, and if you have any questions, I'd be pleased to answer them, or you can contact me at ONA.
Okay. Well, that's good to hear that. There's a little bit of wiggle room. The very first year that I was here, 1999, on the Health Committee, Senator Cruz was the chair, and we had an extensive information from public health. I forget the name of the director at the time. It was before Dr. Higginson, but it was about the pandemic, and it was frightening. And I equate a pandemic with a tsunami. We're going to have them both at some point. We don't know when. And I, the state in the world today is not very stable. There are more poor people in Haiti, for instance. You know, a pandemic could start among the poor in any country and travel very quickly by air and so on, transportation, I mean. So the prospect is getting... The future is more dangerous, I think, than the past, even because of the transportation and the number of people who are being born into the world who are not getting adequate health care. And so we're going to have a pandemic. In fact, when I first introduced that bill to my committee, and didn't get any support, I started by saying, when the next pandemic hits, are we going to be ready? And I still ask that question. When the next pandemic hits, are we going to be ready? I don't know. So, anyway. Other questions, comments? Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Okay. Update on children, adults, families, temporary assistance, needy persons, Aaron Kelly, Seals, Vic Todd, and Corey Murphy.
I don't know if they're
all.
Aaron, do you want all four of you up at the same time?
We'll rotate.
Great.
That's okay.
Okay, you got 5 minutes.
to set up.
Morning, Chair Morissette, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Erin Kelly-Seal, and we have been asked to cover a broad array of topics this morning to provide you with an update generally on two of our major programs in the Children, Adults, and Families Division, and I am the Assistant Director to Bruce Goldberg, the DHS Director, and I do head this particular division. When I was thinking this weekend about what was most important for you to remember, because we are going to provide you with a lot of information, we did include in the PowerPoint probably more than I'm going to be able to get through verbally, but what I was hoping this could become for you is a bit of a reference sheet in terms of a point-in-time look at things that are going on here. But if you look at the last the last page of the PowerPoint that you have in front of you, it's slide 20. These are the main points that I'm hoping that you'll remember about what we talk about today. First of all, that investment in children and their parents does save money. We are very well aware that the topic of conversation in the next legislative session will focus quite a bit on the revenue situation that we're facing, and we're in the process of developing economic data for you to really examine around the value added of investment early. I know that other programs you are very well familiar with also have done some of this analysis, programs in the Commission on Children and Families. But the TANF program that we're going to talk about is an early investment program in children and families, and it does have implications for our foster care program, which costs the state on average per child $23,500 a year. So I just want folks to remember that earlier investment in our families and our TANF program does impact our financial situation. I'm also hoping what you take away is that we actually know in Oregon what to do, similar to the conversation that happened in the seniors arena. We've had some great outcomes in our TANF program and in our child welfare program that we're going to talk with you about today. And those outcomes really are at risk given the current financial situation, but I think it's important to give ourselves some credit for the things that have worked well. We believe in CAF that we can't do this alone, that government should not be on its own in working with children and families, and we strongly have been supporting and implementing policies and practices that engage communities in our work, that engage other systems in our work, and to ultimately be successful, that's what is required. You'll hear this theme come through loud and clear when we talk about TANF, child welfare, and our agenda, particularly around communities of color. And that's the fifth bullet point, is that we really need to make sure that as we do this work that we're benefiting all families, that we're not only benefiting some. That means children of color. It also means rural and urban, that we're paying attention to some of those different dynamics. And also you're going to hear about ORCIDS, and that's our technology system, and the purpose of having that come to you at the end of the conversation is to show you how that system, which we're planning to implement in the spring of next year in child welfare, while we know new technology and its implementation is usually challenging, it is for me anyway, what it's designed to do is promote more efficient, effective cross-systems practice that really does support the good work that's been going on. So that's a summary of kind of what we're going to take you through today, and we'll start with TANF. The Temporary Assistance for Needy Family Programs, and I hope Senator Winters will be okay if I refer to it in its acronym form as TANF for this portion of the presentation. This program today is serving about 27,700 families. And to be eligible for this program, a family must have a child, and they must be living in extreme poverty. So this program today is serving about 50,900 children. And in order to qualify, the family who is applying must earn less than 40% of the federal poverty level. And just to put that in perspective, for a family of three, that means that they're earning on average per month about $616 per month. And that means that if a single parent with two children is working minimum wage about 17 hours a week, she will not or he will not qualify for TANF. So we're talking about a program that's really meeting the needs of our families living in the most extreme form of poverty. And also just a little bit of perspective on that. When you look back at the most recent statewide poverty data on kids, and we're in the process of updating this,
we were only serving about 25% of kids in Oregon living in poverty in the TANF program. So the number of kids in poverty in Oregon is much higher than the number of children being served in this program, and that'll be important when we talk about the impact of poverty on maltreatment, which we will do. TANF has two primary focuses. The first is on meeting the basic family and economic stability needs of a family and their children through some cash assistance. And the second is to help that family become employed, to become independent, self-sufficient, and no longer need the program so that they can financially support their own financial stability. What Oregon has learned in looking at our TANF program is that when families are finally at the point of needing TANF, they usually have zero income. They're not usually families who are living at 40% of the poverty level even. We know that about 30% of the adults on TANF became parents as teenagers. We know that the population that's being served in this program, about 50% of them who are mandatory clients, which means we need to be offering them job support services so they can become employed, also have at least one disability. And this drives a lot of our programming for the employment services we offer. We want to be sure that somebody who can, in order to get someone job ready, they're going to need to address some of their disability issues as well. We do see a connection between adult recipients of TANF and their having received child welfare services as children. And we have a special focus in the program on families most at risk of child welfare entry, and that's our Family Supports and Connections program, and we know that that program currently is only serving about half the need because it's funded at a lower level than is needed to meet the demand. I talked a little bit about the impact of poverty and the TANF program. About 75% of our 82,000 children on a point in time on any given day in child welfare, there are about 8,200 to 500 or so kids. About 75% of those children and their parents would have qualified for TANF. So that shows you just how the two programs work together. What we also know is that looking at just our foster care population, about 36% of children in foster care had been on the TANF program within the previous 2 months. And that has been increasing as the TANF caseload has increased. We also see, you can see the age of kids, the kids moving from TANF to child welfare often under the age of six.
Thank you. Do you have any information about educational attainment of your client families? I mean, I am going to make the wild assumption that most do not have PhDs, but I mean, you know, have high school dropout rates and correlations and.
Co-chair or Senator Winter, Senator Edwards, we can get back to you with some information on that. I think one of the dynamics that we've observed that we are studying right now is the changing TANF population in these difficult economic times. One of the ways we can look at what you're asking is to look at both employment history of our clients, but also the clients who are actively seeking through our programs their GED. And so we do have information about their educational background that we can get back to you on. I don't have it with me today.
Okay. And I don't need it right away, but by session it would be nice to start making those connections. Thank you.
So I mentioned that the recession has greatly impacted. This program is a basic safety net, and what we've seen is that as people's economic, individual, family, and economic situation has declined, so the demand for the program has increased. So the program, much of what we do in DHS has an inverse relationship to the economy, and what we're seeing in this program in particular are the dramatic impacts the economy is having on families with kids. So notably, when I look at this caseload increase slide, what we're trying to show you is one year increments, the percent change in terms of TANF and its various program components. One of the most notable, if you look at this chart, is that two-parent families, which the state has fought to keep on as eligible in the program, over the last 2.5 years, the number of two-parent families accessing the program has increased by almost 260%. When you look at the number of clients that we are serving through our jobs program, so mandatorily needing to be provided with job employment supports or barrier removal kinds of activities so they can gainfully be employed, that population has increased over 100%. And you can see the demand for that at-risk of child welfare entry, that Family Supports and Connections Program, and how high the caseload itself has increased, and that doesn't actually reflect the waiting list that we have for that program and the number of kids and families who require it that aren't getting it right now. I did also want to mention, just to put this in a little bit of a local perspective, that we regularly every month put out a caseload press release that looks at both food stamps and TANF. And in general, statewide, TANF has increased 40% over the last year. But if you look at particular communities, the hit has been even higher. Just over the last year, Lane has had an 8% increase. Coos Curry has had an 18% increase. Crook, Deschutes, Jefferson have had a 14% increase. I know this committee is especially interested in rural communities. Klamath and Lake in the last year has had a 50% increase in their TANF population. And Baker, Union, and Wallawa counties have had 33% increases in their TANF population just over the last year. So pretty significant increases, and our rural communities are seeing some of the highest impacts of that. When you look at the next slide, this is just one of the things that's happened as our caseload has gone up. The revenue supporting the program has gone down. So in addition to not having the funding to meet the increasing demand, except primarily for the cash assistance portion of the program, we've also had our program reduced to balance the budget. And so what we are anticipating is that this program is really at a crossroads going into the next biennium.
I just want to note for the record, because there are people that are probably listening, that on job placements, if you follow the trend lines and given the recession, it's gone down substantially.
I think it is true that our job placement rate is going down, but I also think it's true, remarkably, that we continue to make job placements in this economy. And it's a real challenge for us. Of course, as I mentioned, one of the primary objectives of the program is to help people become independent, to become self-sufficient, care for their own families. It's very difficult to find people jobs when there aren't very many jobs for people to find. And that speaks to the last bullet point on this slide, which is that, in fact, our work participation rate is not meeting the federal requirements for the program at this point in time, and so we have been assessed penalties, which we are appealing. Back to the point I made earlier about the success of the program and how it had been working prior to the economic downturn, what I think is really notable is that in Oregon, our work participation rate prior to the recession was actually better than 33 of states after their adjustment for some caseload reduction and other credits. And so we saw an increase in our workload participation in TANF. We went from about 24% all the way up to about 38% or so in terms of families who were going to work. So when there are jobs available and the programming is available to support people getting those jobs, we've had some really good success in the current program design. But what's happened over the last 2 years, as the funding has been really not meeting and keeping up with the demand for service, is that our workers are really primarily having to focus on eligibility. We're just basically keeping up with the number of people coming into the front door needing that basic stability payment, that basic cash assistance payment. And unfortunately, what you can see here in our third bullet is that our staffing levels for the program have also been declining relative to the workload. So when you look at the folks who are really charged to do things like assess people for their disabilities, assess people for whatever barriers they may have to becoming employed, manage their cases, and work with clients to become employed, we're only staffed at about 42% of the required staffing level to do that work. And what that means, because those staff originally were assumed to be doing both eligibility and case management, is that all those staff are doing is front-loading the eligibility portion of their job.
I just think it's unreasonable to, whether it's Oregon or other states, to expect that in this recession, to expect states to meet, quote, the work participation rates. We just talked earlier about some of the other federal mandates, and I just get a little, very incensed at, what's occurring in Washington and in Region 10. it's not reasonable, and I hope we prevail on your request to them to. And I know Oregon is not alone. I'm sure we're not alone. But I just want the public, because they listen to these hearings, to know that sometimes we get penalized, or there's extemporation action that happens that we have no control over. And this is one of them. This is where you have to appeal to the federal system to say, you know, Oregon has done its best, and look at our track record, and we didn't cause the economic downturn. So just needed to state that.
Thank you, Senator. And we have met with all of our federal delegation members, and they've signed letters of support for Oregon's appeal for exactly the reasons that you mentioned. Slide 5 goes into just painting a picture of between the current service level budget that just was submitted to the governor on September 1st and the actual monetary, the revenue requirement or the revenue need that we would have to meet the statutory requirements that are currently in place for the program, there's almost a $200 million gap. And it's just to put in perspective what we're wrestling with as a program to manage effectively these resources and propose to you options in this reduced revenue environment to continue doing as best we can to meet the needs of children and families in this particular environment. And it shows you, I think, it highlights for you why we believe that this program is going to need to be right-sized going into the next session. And I think we're all going to need to have a very thoughtful policy conversation about what the program needs to look like during this period, which we hope to not be going on forever.
Senator Edwards.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As a just general percent of your budget, you talked about the shortfall. What percent of the money for the program goes to direct cash assistance payments versus, you know, I mean, obviously you have to maintain a staff and caseworkers and everything to, you know, administer the program, but just trying to get a general sense.
Senator Edwards, we can get back to you with exactly a breakdown in the current service level budget, but just in general, what I can tell you is that the vast majority in this program is going to clients in the form of cash assistance payments, but there is about 30% to 40% that is also purchasing through contractors those jobs services. So the majority of it is cash assistance payments, and then the next biggest increment is the increment that we pay out to our contractors to support the job and employment search efforts that our clients receive. And then the smallest amount goes to our direct service staff. And we can give you the exact percentage breakdowns. I just don't have my chart with me. It's okay. So I'm just going to keep moving forward, but I think this is just this will highlight what I just said in terms of the critical choices that we're facing. We really don't have many options with this program. It is not a mandatory program, according to our budget. It's a block-granted program that the federal government provides a block grant to Oregon. We then have a maintenance of effort requirement. Every new case coming onto TANF now is being paid for entirely with general fund. We have exhausted all of our federal fund resources in the program. And it technically is optional at the federal level for us to even have a TANF program, which is why, from a budgetary perspective, the view is that this program is non-mandatory. So what we have to be able to do, I think, going forward together is have a conversation about, in an environment where we clearly do not have enough resources to meet the needs of the number of families that are needing these services, what is Oregon's program going to look like? And can we maintain some of the policy goals that we had set in the past for the program, particularly looking at the issues of family stability and child safety?
Aaron, question, because even though it is block grant, are there some sideboards, federal sideboards, onto the program itself?
Senator Winters, there are. Only certain kinds of things count as work in the program, and what Oregon has learned is that most of those activities are not relevant to the population that we're serving, or there are such limits on the activities that it makes it difficult for the population we're serving to actually benefit from them. So there are limitations on the block grant, and they're the drivers of the penalty requirement. The other disconnect that we've experienced with our federal partner on this, although I think there are some in leadership in the new administration who see the connection, Oregon is out in front making the connection between foster care and TANF. There are other states that don't track that data. We've been looking for it, and they just quite frankly don't ask. They haven't made it so that their data systems can track that particular data set. It's actually one of our key performance measures with you all as a legislature. It's something that we've prioritized in the state. So other states have, after the Deficit Reduction Act passed, really shifted their focus almost exclusively to the employment issue, which we continue to maintain a focus on, but we have broadened our conversation to also focus on the outcomes to children in the program because, as originally designed, the program is a children's program. So we've been struggling with our federal partners around that issue and having them appreciate the need to at least begin tracking data around the child outcomes relative to the program, and not only to require states to provide data about the employment outcomes. We think both are very important. This is where I think the conversation about those long-term implications for foster care is just really important to make. And one of the things that I want to just make sure this committee appreciates is that poverty is the single best predictor of child maltreatment. That doesn't mean that all people who are poor are abusive or neglectful of their children. But what the data has shown is that children and families with incomes below $15,000 per year are 22 times more likely to be abused or neglected than those living in families with incomes of $30,000 or more. And so when we start to look then at our child welfare data and we look at the connectedness between TANF, which is a program for children and families living in extreme poverty, and then you look at foster care and the fact that 36% of those kids in care had come from TANF, it really shouldn't be surprising to our federal partners, but we need the policies between these programs to align. Our view of TANF is that it's a prevention program. It's also a self-sufficiency program, and what it does is help keep families together. And I want to talk a little bit in child welfare about how that's a priority for us, but I'm just going to start in the child welfare piece on some of our basic data. Before I go there, and Vic Todd has graciously been sitting with me, he's the administrator of our self-sufficiency programs, are there any other questions about TANF that we can answer? Okay. So I was also asked this morning to update you on some of our outcomes in child welfare and work that we're doing there to make to improve our services to the children and families we work on behalf of. This slide just gives you a picture of the number of calls, reports of abuse and neglect we're getting, and the number of confirmed victims in 2009. You can see that about 13,000 children experienced foster care in 2009, and you can see what our average daily population has been. It also gives you some statistics on reunification, adoption, and guardianship. And what I want to highlight here is that for many people, it is surprising to learn that almost 60% of kids who come into the foster care system go home to their parents. And that's a really important data point for us. It's driving many of our conversations about our strategic improvement efforts. I did want to remind you that we have, over the last 2 years, tried to focus our attention in the foster care system on improvements in some very key areas. We have set targeted goals for ourselves in foster care to increase the number of children who remain safely at home with their parent and therefore eliminate the need for them to come into foster care. We're working very hard to improve both placements and connections with relatives, family, and individuals known to the children. And we're very committed to increasing the number of children who timely leave foster care either to reunite with their family or to be adopted or go into a guardianship placement. And we are doing all these things with a close eye on both safety, which is the mission of child welfare, we're there to protect kids, and also on the issue of equity, to be sure that no one group of children is benefiting from these efforts more than another. And we have some challenges in this area because we know that currently children of color, particularly African American and Native American children, are overrepresented in the foster care system as compared to the general population. And Corey Murphy is here to talk with you more about that in just a minute. For kids who do require foster care, We have these goals. We have the goal of timely and appropriately meeting their medical and behavioral health needs. We want to be sure that we're providing meeting their needs in such a way that their placement situation is stable and that their services are actually addressing the individual needs of each child. And it's our ambition to eliminate abuse in foster care. One of the reasons we understand very well that placement in foster care should be a safe haven for children, and this is a big priority for us, and we've had several changes to our system that we'll show you. And if you look at this slide, some of the results that we're getting relative to those goals that I've just talked about. In 2009 compared to 2008, there were 10% fewer kids who experienced foster care in the state. We've actually seen our system become safer with our re-abuse rate declining. We've seen fewer kids leave foster care and come back. We've increased our first placements with relatives by over 20%. We've increased the number of kids who stable and have two or fewer placements in foster care by 10%. We're getting better at getting kids referred for mental health assessments, and the mental health system is getting better at providing those in a timely way for our kids. We've reduced abuse in foster care by 32%, and we continue to focus on maintaining active face-to-face contact with kids, and we've seen that number go up just slightly as well. One of our obligations annually is to provide you with a report about foster care stability, and so you also have that in front of you as a handout. There was a statute passed in 2007 that requires this report of us, and what I've done on this slide is highlight some of the data and information that you have in this longer report for reading at your leisure. We are getting better at actually having children in our care experience only a single placement, which is, of course, the goal, because we know that any time a child moves, that's very difficult for the child, and it has implications for both their personal stability and safety, but also then for their education and other factors that are influencing their well-being. We're doing better at keeping kids with relatives, and this, again, as I mentioned, has been a priority for us, and also we're doing better at keeping kids who have siblings together with at least one of those siblings. One of the things you'll see in this report, and I wanted to just highlight it because I know it caught my attention, and I'm sure that it will catch yours. On the second or third of the six pages, you'll see a chart, and this law actually requires us by children in our system at a point in time. So this was by children in foster care on March 31st of 2010. We have illustrated for you how many placements each of those children has had. And you will see that there are some children who we have not done as well as we would have liked to, and who have had multiple placements. I wanted to explain that to you a little bit. First of all, we certainly have more work to do in this area, and we need to continue to focus on reducing the number of placements for kids. But there are a couple of other factors that influence these numbers. One is the way that we capture what we call respite care. So one of the things that happens for foster parents is that they sometimes need a break. And in our system, in order to provide a foster parent with a break, you have to be a approved respite care provider. For some of these kids who've had multiple placements, our system actually captures as a placement move when they go to a respite care provider for the weekend, and then another placement move when they come back to their original foster care placement. That's one issue, and it's something that we've been working on both from a systems and a personnel perspective. But it's important for us to track where our kids are at all times, because they are our kids. We are their guardians. And so that's one of the reasons you see these many moves. Another reason is that when a child in foster care runs away and then comes back, that's considered a placement move, even if they come back to the same home they were in prior to running away. A third reason is that any time a child with high needs goes into a residential treatment setting, that's considered a placement move. Even if they come back to the same foster parent after leaving that residential treatment setting, that would be three placements. The first placement in foster care, the placement in the residential treatment, and then the placement back in the same family where they had been. So some of these kids who've been in care for a long time and who are older and have very significant needs have had many placement moves. And I wanted to tell you the story of our child who's here on the bottom who has had 70 placement counts in our system.
I was going to ask. So.
In this example, this child actually has moved, and this is not a happy story, between 7 different care providers during the time period in care, several of whom were identified as respite care. But the good news about the story is there were 3 unique providers for this child in the last 7.5 years, and in the last 2.5 years, this child has had 1 placement and has been stable. So we have a story here of a kiddo who had some really significant needs. We struggled to find the right placement fit for that child. They went in and out of respite and some residential care, but we've done better over the last 5.5 years minimizing the moves for this child. But this child will always be in our system as having had 70, 71 placement moves. And so this will show up every year in your report. And I just wanted to be sure to tell you that story because it is one that stands out in the report itself.
Have you done any longitudinal studies on children who have left the system? And probably there would be no reason to do that. You know, how many of these kids become college presidents and how many end up in prison?
Chair Morissette, there have been studies done. One of the most noteworthy was done by KCE Family Programs, and they actually combined Oregon and Washington data, so it's very relevant to us. It does not highlight some of the successes, which I have personally had the opportunity to meet many, many foster kids who've done amazing things. It instead highlights some of the more likely to kinds of situations, and unfortunately, kids who are exiting foster care and have not been placed permanently back with a relative or in an adoption or guardianship are more likely to have challenges. They're more likely to be on public assistance. They're more likely to become homeless. They're less likely to be educated in terms of higher education, and they're often more likely to come into contact with the criminal justice system later in their lives. So it is one of the reasons that we're focusing on avoiding foster care whenever we can. One of the reasons the TANF program is very important to foster care is that we believe that families are better parents than the state. And we support and strongly are appreciative of all of our foster parents who serve our kids when they need foster care. But in the long run, we know that it's better for children to be with their families. You also know that in 2007, our program, the Child Welfare Program, foster care standing alone is a mandatory program, and we receive federal matching dollars for just out-of-home care. We receive no federal money, very little. There's a very small amount of Title 4B, but very little federal money in support of keeping children safely with their families in the foster care system. The majority of it goes to supporting kids in foster care, which is another malaligned incentive from our perspective from our federal partner. In conjunction with the federal revenue we get reviewed by the federal government in terms of the quality of our system. And in 2007, we had a review. We were not passing. We set goals. We had a program improvement plan. And I'm happy to report that we're almost nearing the end of our improvement plan, and we have met the six national goals and composite measures. And in some cases, we're exceeding the national goal or national standard in these measures. So this will highlight those for you. There were also 2 Oregon-specific goals that we are making progress toward but have not yet. One is around our ability to, when we get a report of abuse, in a timely way, go out on that report. This is a reflection, in my view, of our workload challenges in child welfare. We are not 100% staffed in child welfare. And the number of calls that we are getting in child welfare continues to rise. We've also implemented a more comprehensive approach to our evaluation of those reports of abuse and neglect, and it takes more time to do. So we're struggling in this area, but we're continuing to make some progress. It's actually a major focus for us right now because it is a challenge for many more of our districts than it has been in the past. The other issue for us is services to children to keep them safely at home. We're in the process of redesigning our in-home service support system and making progress again toward that particular goal. One of our commitments.
I can go back a little bit on the abuse and neglect reporting and looking at all states, or pretty much all states in alignment as with their legislation and their reporting requirements. Are there some variations?
Senator Winters, I might need to get back to you with more information on that. Every state's definition of abuse or neglect is slightly different. And I would need to look more closely at, as compared to other states, in terms of who are mandatory reporters. Am I answering that,
because that has a lot to do with the numbers, quite frankly, and whether or not California is similar to Oregon, particularly when I'm looking at the feds now and how they assess the states. And so I just would like to have some kind of a thumbnail look at how we compare with others and whether the reporting is similar, because the reporting does have a lot to do with the numbers and the outcome.
And Senator, Chair Morissette, Senator Winters, we can get you some additional information on other states around the reporting requirements. I also wanted just to provide you...
I raise that because often we get penalized for doing good in Oregon. Just hope you're listening, Washington.
I'm sure they're tuned in right now.
We also are committed to accountability and transparency in our child welfare system, and there are a couple of sources for you if you're interested in knowing what your local data looks like or how we're doing on a month-to-month basis in your community around these different measures. And these two web links will take you to that information. I'm also happy to tell you that in the spring, we will be launching, with the support of KC Family Programs, we'll be launching an interactive website that will allow folks to get ask questions about our data and actually have answers to things that maybe aren't, we don't normally report out on in our data book. This is a point in time I want to turn it over to Corey Murphy. Corey is our equity coordinator, and as I mentioned, one of our primary goals is to ensure that all of these improvement efforts, as we look to improve the number of kids, increase the number of kids who can stay safely with parents, improve our timeliness of reunification or adoption, we want to make sure that they benefit all families. And what we know about the system right now is that we are struggling with some families in particular, and I'm going to let Corey talk a little bit about that.
Good morning, Chair Morissette and Senator Winters, Senator Edwards, and Senator Amonis Anderson. My name is Corey Murphy. I am I'm an operations and policy analyst for the Department of Human Services. My specific title is the Child Welfare Equity Coordinator, which an assignment that I took on about maybe about a year and a half ago. I'm just going to jump right in, and I won't be in front of you very long, but I hope to give you some good information about what we've discovered along the last year and a half, and maybe where our next steps are regarding child welfare equity, or what some and many have heard is the issue around disproportionality. When I hear about the issues of TANF and of the child welfare system, it's very interesting that although these are very difficult situations that all of our kids and families in Oregon are facing, unfortunately, like many other states, just about every other state in the country, these realities impact children of color, specifically African American and Native American kids and families, most negatively. And that's the section of the next five slides that I want to really hit here. I'm not going to insult your intelligence by reading these particular definitions. However, I think when you look at the issue of disproportionality and disparity, the difference really is around what you're comparing. So in disproportionality, you're comparing your population of what you're measuring versus the population in the area. So in child welfare, for example, you'll see the data here in a second, but there is a blatant disproportionality or imbalance around kids who are in the system versus kids who are in the general population. The disparity will then compare people group to people group, if you will, and we'll see sort of a little bit how that goes as well. The one thing I think we find is that you say, well, why is this happening? And I think that's the major question that everyone wants to know. Well, in 2008, the Government Accountability Office report came out specifically around African Americans, but if you really dig in, there are some transferable lessons here. And it came up with three answers to the question. One was poverty, which we just heard. Again, these extraneous situations really bear down on communities of color most negatively. Access to appropriate services and bias, stereotyping, and racism. And again, I just want to really drive the point home that these, what we're looking at are very multi-contingent, very converging factors that create this inequity. What you're seeing here, I want to point out, and on this slide is on the top graph. Notice the percent of Oregon's children for African American kids, and the percent of children served in foster care. Okay, it's about 2-3 to 4 times the amount there. If you drop down a couple of lines, looking at Native American, obviously that sort of tells the story. If you combine the two together, 2.4 and 1.3, I'm not a math major necessarily, but 3.7% total of children in Oregon, but they make up roughly 17% of Oregon's child welfare system. Obviously, it's something that we really are aiming to get a handle on. If you look at the bottom, I think there's some pieces there to notice as well. Year 2007, 8, and 9 for African American children continue to increase. In fact, if you were to go back to 2000, you would see very similar trends. But for the most part, if you look at Oregon's percent of children, it's still around that 2-3%. So you can see that over the last 10 years, there really has been a disproportionate amount of black kids in the foster care system. If you look also at Native American children, again, going back to the 1.3% of Oregon's children being Native American, you'll also see a trend that is maintaining as well. What I can say about this is if you drop all the way down to the unknown, not recorded, and you see the drop between 2000 and 2009, this was a direct result of the agency, of our department, wanting to make a concentrated effort to ensure that data collection and reporting was accurate. And so we wanted to reduce the number of unknowns because, okay, so we're all known, right? I mean, but in our system, it's hard to track that many times. So, and we'll get to that, some of that a little bit later with the ORCID's presentation. I simply wanted to only point out, though, that because of that drop from 2008 to 2009, look at the Hispanic and erase. So when I started to really look at this, I started to really be concerned about an increase of Hispanic children over the years, and I would say that we should really put that on our radar as we're moving forward. Slide 16 shows some of the reduction efforts that we've made in the past year and a half or so.
When you talk about the Hispanic children, does it make a difference if they're legal or illegal?
Chair Morissette, the child welfare system serves all kids. It does not matter whether they're documented or not.
Okay. Well, it's kind of interesting because if they're born here, they're citizens. If they're not born here, they're not. That is irrelevant, though. But I mean, there's a lot of interesting dynamics within that whole area.
And Chair Morissette, we did, in the last year, we have established both diversity and immigration experts in our division because the issues become more complicated, as you might imagine. Any child who's being hurt, it's our obligation. We don't ask, are you a citizen before we go help them. But sometimes the complexity of a case is a lot higher when you're dealing with both issues of culturally appropriate service and then in addition to that, issues relating to immigration. And we've seen that not just for Hispanic kids, but we serve kids in our system who are immigrants from many, many countries.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Corey, does your stats correlate with the statistics in our other institutions?
Chair Morissette and Senator Winters, the correlation is actually...
there's a disproportionate number of African Americans and other minorities in our institutions.
Yes.
And so, we might as well say what is. Mm-hmm. And so is there a correlation with the kids as well? You mentioned some of the factors already, and, we haven't eliminated institutional racism in this state and in this country.
Yeah, Senator Winters, you're absolutely right. You can find inverse disparities, research shows, around the underserving of kids, black kids and Native American kids in mental health and health care and in education. They perform more poorly in education. You will find those disparities pertaining to poverty, which now research is beginning to show that those underserving in those systems relate to the overserving in child welfare and in juvenile justice systems, and then into the adult corrections as well.
Thank you. Along those lines, and I can't remember the exact percentage, is it 80% of the kids that are in the foster care system have parents that are incarcerated? There's a huge percentage, and I might be way off on that. Do you recall that?
Chair Morissette, Senator Mona Sanderson, we look in the data book, we look specifically at the issue of incarceration as it relates to why kids come into care. It's actually a pretty low number.
Okay.
It's more common that we're coming into contact with kids for other reasons like drug and alcohol abuse. Sometimes parental contact with law enforcement is listed. Let me just grab that page. But it's not as high. It's not as high as 80%.
If I could, Chair Morissette, I would also like to respond also to Senator Winter's comment about institutional racism. Absolutely, that is a long journey that our state and other states across the country are coming along. Obviously, we have so far to go, but I can simply say that that our department is not afraid of creating an efficient and effective system to mitigate that. But I can simply say that the department could do all that it could around that area, and we would still most likely see these disparities because of the interconnectedness of the problem and the historical structural reality of the problem that really has to be addressed. So I'm simply saying that we could do all of the adjustments and improvements that we want internally, which we will continue to do and we must do in order to maintain the current level of effectiveness and increase it. However, will not be enough to balance out the imbalance that we currently see.
Well, just once we become a colorblind society, then it will solve some of the problems that we're talking about, because that's what permeates all of this. And from what I think about you, or what somebody else thinks about somebody else, and what have you, and it becomes stereotypical, these stereotypes, and including in our other systems, that just certain groups can't learn, and these kinds of things carry themselves forward. I ask the questions on corrections because of some of the discussion that has gone around that whole criminal justice issue and why we have the disparities inside of that particular system, and whether there is a nexus between that and what you find in foster care.
There is another data statistic that I've heard, I don't know how true it is, but I think it is partially true, that if a parent has been incarcerated, the chances of the child will become incarcerated are much higher. I don't know if there's a correlation, a study or whatever on that, but there should be some predictors that you would be paying attention to. Gee, if that's the case, then we have to make sure that you're getting the right kind of treatment before you fall into that trap.
And Senator Morissette, just on that note, relating back to Senator Mona Sanders' question, it's actually a very low percentage of kids who come into the system because a parent has been incarcerated. It's about 1.3%. But that doesn't necessarily capture if they have a two-parent household and they were able to safely be with their dad, for instance, and their mom was incarcerated, and then something happened with dad. So that number is really, why did we have to actually bring a child into foster care? And just as a reminder, the biggest reason for bringing kids into care is parent drug and alcohol abuse, and there's also domestic violence.
And what percentage is that? Maybe that's the percentage I'm
Well, drug and alcohol abuse is listed about 56% of the time as a reason kids come into care. Mm-hmm. So there are usually multiple factors that get checked. It's not just one thing that we check, and so that could be together with an incarceration, but it also stands alone the majority of the time.
Senator or Chair Morissette, I'd like to continue with this couple of slides here left. This slide shows that the department is aligning its policy and practices and contracting to be more inclusive of the needs of the communities. We've learned along the way that listening and acting on what we learn from various communities, whether they be communities driven by the racial or ethnic makeup or the economic disadvantage of some communities, we understand that it is important for us to listen and to act on those. And this is a list of some of the efforts and the achievements that we're working on currently, focusing on aligning systems and agencies together with the KC Partnership, and as well as focusing on recruitment, hiring, and retention, train development with the CAP Diversity Unit. And again, you will hear more about the ORCIDS project shortly. Yes.
Chair Morissette, if I could, I just want to highlight the fact that the courts have made a commitment to this, as well as the Commission on Children and Families. And this is important to us for several reasons. No child enters or leaves foster care without the support of our judicial branch. And so we've got to have them involved in terms of our decision making, because they are decision makers and overseers of our work. And I'm very grateful that the Judicial Department has stepped up and said that our safe and equitable reduction effort is one of their top priorities. The Chief Justice a few weeks ago with the Governor signed in front of all of the juvenile court judges a commitment to this work. And they're putting in place some things which we'll talk about in a minute that are designed to help reinforce the objectivity that every judge expects of themselves, but we know that all of us uniquely have our own implicit bias, and so they're putting in place some tools around their decision making, like the department is trying to do with some of our changes as well. And in partnership, we're very excited about some of the potential of being able to have more objective, fair decisions for all kids as a result of that.
You know, and we're talking about kids in the system, Mr. Chair, but it's my hope that at some point we get communities energized enough to prevent kids from getting into the system in the first place. You know, once we get tagged, or kids get tagged and families get tagged into the system, it is extremely hard to actually get out of, whether it's the legal process or other processes. And, you know, for me, I like to see the investment on the front end, you know, some of the work that we're doing here in Marion County to try to work with families and others to prevent, you know, some of the abuse and neglect in the beginning, and the work that Commissioner of Children and Families are doing. I think we constantly have to be reactive as a state, but at some point we've got to be proactive before some of the damage is done in our communities and in families. You know, there was a time when we lived in neighborhoods and we knew that we had families, and now we're scattered all over everywhere. So the state has become the family. It'd be kind of nice to go back to where the community becomes the family again. So just had that.
Okay. we have one more panel after you're through, and it's, so we're going to have to do it.
So I simply wanted to share the work up to date of our Child Welfare Equity Task Force. Let me highlight one or two of the pieces on this particular slide. The first one is that communities need to be engaged and included as collaborative partners. There's no way that we can improve child safety and family stability without the involvement and partnership and true collaboration with communities and the programs and the systems and the networks that exist in these communities. The third bullet down, the true elimination of this particular trend across the country really does include the increase of other services. I mean, we, as Senator Winters just said, we need to improve the access and the appropriateness of those services so that before we need to bring them into the system, they have the supports that they need, access in there, and it's relevant to how they view the world, okay? The last thing here is that that cultural humility, accountability, and transparency are critical to sustain success. One thing that I've learned along the way is that our tribal partners really just want accountability, and they want that accountability to be, in a sense, enforced, for lack of a better term. In other words, what they want is the not just the letter of the Indian Child Welfare Act to be followed, but the heart and the spirit of it as well. And once we get to that point, I think that we continually see not only partners growing in these other communities of color, again, specifically African American communities, but also with our tribal partners across the state. Next steps with our work toward equity, we have our preliminary report that will be available sometime in October. We do currently have very strong recommendations and plans. I just want to make note that this is not just a report that's based on, it is a report that's based on data and not just recommendations, but we have a plan, and we want to really begin to move and implement things immediately. Our final full task force report will be presented sometime in December. And obviously there you have other pieces of our timeline. But I guess in closing this particular piece, states cannot afford to continue to make this sort of a someone else's issue. This is becoming all of our issue, and it is a very interconnected, a very multifaceted problem, which requires a very collaborative, multifaceted solution. Child welfare can only do so much. It's not just a child welfare problem, but it is a community and system-wide problem. So I appreciate your time.
And the last bullet point on this slide mentions that we have a new technology system that we're launching in support of our child welfare work and best practice, and that is our ORCID system. And so I'm going to let Mish Matz introduce herself and take you through that portion of our presentation, which should be pretty quick so you can keep moving forward.
Okay.
I might need a little bit of help with this.
Hello, my name is Mish Matz, and I am an operations and policy analyst, and I work on the ORCIDS project. My specific area is eligibility and financials, but I also sit on the governor's task force, the equity task force. And
there
so
are things we know for sure.
Oh, it's obvious. So before we start, and it's only actually 4 minutes long, I just wanted to sum up and touch on some things that were talked about today. There were lots of questions asked of us about how we're looking at data, what we can answer, what we can't answer, and a part of the progressive thinking that has been going on is the investment in the ORCIDS project. So it will afford us the ability to track and gather data on the education of a child through the system, and that's actually through now it's beyond the age of 18 because of some changes that have been made. It will allow us to get information as well as store it and share it with other agencies as far as medical information, immunizations being one of the things that was discussed today, so as well as other medical information. So those are just a few of the things. I won't have time today to go into all of the things that would be beneficial for you to know, but just so that you are aware of the wonderful investment that the agency is making in doing some of these changes. So
that building a better tomorrow means investing in today. Nothing worth investing in. There are things we know for sure. That building a better tomorrow means investing in today. Nothing worth investing in can be accomplished alone, and the foundation of our society rests on the premise of people helping people. DHS is the embodiment of things we know for sure, and these are basic tenets of the work that we do. We help our families build better tomorrows. We invest today in better ways to meet these goals, and we provide the framework both within and across systems to support the people we serve. An investment that DHS has made is in a data program that will help support many of the agency goals. While there are many functions within ORCIDS, the focus of this presentation today is how it will support the continuity of best practice in child welfare, promote efficiency, and improve cross-systems connectivity for more coordination of care. Each worker who interacts with the ORCIDS system will have a desktop that represents many aspects of the discrete data that the system can capture. ORCIDS will promote efficiency in the work of child welfare, such as quality assurance and program evaluation through performance measures, fiscal tracking to quantify the downstream costs of youth and families in the system, as well as potential savings, and accurate data capture for timely federal reporting. The automated fiscal aspect of ORCIDS will allow for the tracking and control of costs within the agency, from payments to reimbursables, with the ability to capture transactions by both branch and state per individual budget line. A unique function for fiscal tracking is the maintenance and tracking of system of care dollars. Currently, there is no such feature in our data systems to input monies for branches and track how the dollars are spent. ORCIDS will allow for a more efficient means to both gather information for the adoption and foster care analysis and reporting system required for federal reporting and compile these reports in a more timely fashion. This can also help reduce the workload for current analysts, thereby freeing them up to address much-needed data analysis to inform program improvement. In addition, all AFCAR's data fields must be completed by child welfare caseworkers for federal data reporting before a case can be closed. ORCIDS will support more cross-systems connectivity for improved coordination of care, such as NYTD and ILP data capture, OHP alignment with healthy kids, HB 3114 psychotropic meds, immunizations database interface, and future capabilities will include wraparound initiative tracking, HB 2144. The ORCID structure affords the user the ability to gather information on TANF, food stamps, and community services received. This data can then be tracked and analyzed in report format to support improvement in the service development needed by our current system. And the ILP, or Independent Living Program Services screen, captures services provided to the older youth that we serve. The use of ORCID's functionality will also support best practice, adherence to policy, and allow a consistent and standard delivery of care in its OHP alignment with healthy kids. House Bill 2116. ORCIDS will support policy by capturing children receiving medication as a part of a larger, comprehensive plan of care and provides a structure to track strict consent and oversight procedures. ORCIDS will support the continuity of child welfare best practice, such as the standardization of the Oregon safety model, the ability to track ICWA and refugee status, and the promotion of equitable decision-making. The OSM model in ORCIDS requires documenting comprehensive family functioning assessments and requires the worker to do this through the lens of each family's cultural and/or ethnic needs. This model continues with the documentation required by the worker to show diligent efforts made both in working with families as well as increasing placements with extended family. ORCIDS has tracking features such as foster care recruitment events to support the DHS goal of keeping children close to home if they cannot be placed with a relative. ORCIDS will enhance the department's ability to implement the Equity Task Force recommendations by allowing better cross-systems data sharing and tracking, better analysis of root causes and whether strategies of change are working, and supporting policy changes that are designed to promote equitable decision-making on the ground and at an administrative level. In all, ORCIDS will capture strategic information, promote efficiency, support cross-systems connectivity, and support continuity of child welfare best practice at an investment that will save Oregon taxpayers, under relatively conservative assumptions, approximately $2.02 for each dollar invested in its development. Through investment in systems like ORCIDS, DHS can improve practice, and when system practices improve in regards to disproportionate groups, it will ultimately guarantee equal treatment outcomes for all youth and families, regardless of race, ethnicity, and national origin.
This is a real page turner. I've never been through 17 pages so quickly. 21 pages. Amazing. Very good.
So, Chair Morissette and members of the committee, just in closing, thank you so much for the time today to highlight some of the good work, some of the challenges that we're having, and some of the opportunities. We look forward to more discussion with you about how best to serve the children and families that have needs that we're meeting currently, and needs maybe we're not meeting, and we thank you so much for your time.
Okay. Mickey Cerise, is one of the best things that you have going for you in your department. I have to say that anytime that I've had a problem, I called Mickey, gave him the information. He would call immediately and then get back with me to let me know what's going on, and I think that is phenomenal. Give him a raise.
Thank you so much.
Okay, thanks.
It's easy for you to say you're on the way out.
Yeah.
I have to come back and deal with the budget next session.
Okay, we have, let's see. Okay, update on the Oregon Hunger Task Force. Patty Whitney Wise, Danella Dodson, and Noreen Goplan. Okay. We saved the very best until last.
The best for last, and we promise to be brief. Good morning, Chair Morissette and members of the committee. I'm Patty Whitney Wise, the director for the Oregon Hunger Task Force. I wanted to share with you a little bit of what we discussed at our task force meeting 2 weeks ago. We felt it was really important with all of the budget cuts happening and the numbers you're looking at to put a face on some of the families that we're hearing about in our local communities. Oregon is a place that cares deeply about our families and our communities and our natural resources, and we want them all to be healthy. The task force was created in 1989 to make sure that all families have enough food to eat and that it's good food so that they can develop and thrive in their local communities. We've been alarmed at the rise of hunger over time here in Oregon, and much has been done about this issue. Just a brief bit of history: when Governor Kulongoski took up this issue when he was first elected governor, he wanted to lay the issue in everyone's lap so that we did something to address hunger in our communities. We were number one in hunger at that point in time. And we helped develop a 5-year plan, Act to End Hunger, 40 ways in 5 years to make a difference, and worked with the administration and throughout the state and made progress on 30 of the 40 items in that plan. And in fact, we moved the needle on hunger. We went from number one in hunger to number 23 in hunger, about in the middle of the states. And then once the recession hit, we just plummeted right back down to number two. What we know is that hunger is the canary in the mine shaft, that it's indicative of larger financial problems for families. Poverty is the biggest indicator of hunger. And as we moved into a very deep recession, during the good times, low-income and low-wage families were able to make ends meet with the jobs that they had. But once the recession hit and they lost those jobs, they had not been able to save money for the hard times. They were just making ends meet. And so our numbers in hunger rose dramatically as those families used up what little savings they had while they were looking for new jobs. When we met on December 10th, there was a lot of concern expressed, especially around the impact of hunger on children, affecting their learning, their health, and their future productivity. And there were personal stories shared that we wanted to bring to you today. So I would like to turn the mic over to both Danalda Dodson and Noreen Goplan, who are members of the task force, to share these stories.
Chair Morissette, members of the committee, I'm Danalda Dodson. I work for Oregon Child Development Coalition. We are a migrant and seasonal and Oregon pre-kindergarten program, and I'm a member of the Hunger Task Force. And I just want to put a face of our economic times on, or put a person to that face, I guess, and give you a couple stories that just came to my attention. One has to do with a family, and I'll give fictitious names to, you know, maintain their privacy. One is Jim. He was employed in the mortgage business, which, you know, was not the place to be employed. And so after about 4 cuts in his business, he also received a layoff notice. He was concerned because he has a family. First, he went to the employment office and became discouraged when the employment office said, there are just no jobs for you to apply for. Every morning was seeking employment. Every morning was the same thing. There's just nothing to apply for. He and his wife became concerned about how they were going to pay for the ongoing bills. They had food, shelter, and especially they needed to maintain transportation if he's to continue to look for a job. So that was critical. Then they said, how do you pay for utilities? COBRA became an availability for him because he was laid off, but how do you pay the premium for COBRA benefits? There were also delay tactics by his employer, who said, you're not eligible for COBRA. You were laid off.
So we had to go through all those steps in order to get that okay to get the medical coverage. Unemployment barely covered the car payment so that they could continue to seek employment and to pay for some utilities. Where was food, medical, and rent going to come from? This situation has led to depression and withdrawal. The reason for the withdrawal from community and activities is because, as Jim put it, do you know how many people ask you what you do when you're in an interaction in a social setting? And him being unemployed, he became resistant to saying, I'm unemployed, after so many months. This situation has led to some depression, and it also has led to the need for family to step in. In this situation, they were fortunate that they have family that steps in and has helped with them. But as situation would have it, no employment, no health insurance, and then one of the children breaks a limb. So what do? You go to what you have, which is your credit card, to pay for health care costs. So this family is continuing to seek employment, and family members are stepping up to help them with this. But it continues to be a source of concern for the family and extended family. A second family that lives in the neighborhood, I'll call the Hostas, and this is one of their children came next door to the neighbor to say, do you have a loaf of bread that I might use, borrow, because the children have no food for lunch. The neighbor also was inquired by this person asking for the loaf of bread. Also, do you happen to have any extra school supplies? Because my children have no school supplies. The neighbor, of course, gave the loaf of bread and gave the school supplies so that this child could go to school with the needed supplies. This just gives you a little flavor of how children are being impacted by the economic situation of our state. Now I'll pass it on to Maureen, who can tell you about another situation.
Greetings, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Noreen Goplin. I live at Welch's, Oregon, and I am the public policy person for the Lutheran community in Oregon, the ELCA, and I am the lead convener of the Oregon Faith Roundtable Against Hunger. This is an effort of many denominations and faith communities to address hunger. My work routinely has me in contact with congregations of many denominations who are responding to hunger in their neighborhoods. While most of them support the food banks and their relationship with the Oregon Food Bank, they also are moved to provide additional hunger ministries. They may be sit-down dinners, food boxes, backpack buddies, financial assistance, as most pastors and congregations have a type of friend-in-need donation system in place. Repeatedly, congregations, and this is throughout the state, tell me of starting additional food ministries and seeing their capacity to respond overwhelmed. They would begin the offering of meals for 20 or 30 people, and within months are serving over 250 people. People have medical needs. I love the reference to the broken arm because boys do break their arms. One of our pastors told me of a son's arm that was broken, and his family pulled together the financial resources to get it set at an emergency facility. But when it came time to have that cast taken off, then the father was inquiring among friends, do you know how to take the cast off, because he couldn't afford to go back, and was looking for help because he was fairly sure that the broken arm was healed by that point. Our sons, my sons too, broke their arms a lot. Higher numbers of people have been receiving 72-hour eviction notices. We have six congregations in the Portland metro area that provide moving services, and they are absolutely overwhelmed. We can't take any more requests. People needing help in moving their stuff to storage, and then no information about where they plan to live, whether it's in their vehicle or what they're planning to do. Families where elders are now supporting their kids and grandchildren. The stability of the elders' home and their small social security checks are the resources these families have to rely on. In other cases, the sandwich generations, where adult parents are now caring for unemployed, post-college-age children, and trying to meet the needs of their elderly parents who never planned for this change in economy and now are suffering the loss or reduction of their pensions. All of these stories are tales of Oregonians in crisis. They're the faces behind the statistics. You should know that your faith communities throughout the state are very responsive to these needs, but they are also overwhelmed. So members of the Oregon community also need to have the collaboration of state agencies and the essential services they provide.
And this is Patty Whitney Wise. Just to wrap up, in closing, we wanted to request you again to strengthen the safety net here in Oregon, that we cannot afford to shred it any further and still protect our most valuable resource, our children and our families. Secondly, as Patty Brost mentioned in her presentation, I wanted to assure you that we are approaching the revenue committee's members, and we are aware that for the first time in Oregon history, the tax expenditure side of the budget, those dollars that go back to taxpayers in the forms of tax credits and reductions and deductions, now exceeds the amount of money we spend as a state on education, public safety, and human services combined. We believe that Oregonians want better for their state, and we urge you all to really work hard to find the means of helping Oregonians weather this recession and come out the other end into a bright future. Thank you for your time today, and I will give you copies of our testimony so you have that with you.
You may remember Senator Frank Shields.
Yes, very well. He served on the task force.
Well, he had a bill that established a pilot project for religious organizations, you know, working with the state to solve the problems. And I think that is exactly what you're doing. I mean, you're taking advantage of institutions that already exist for that purpose.
Absolutely. And what we're saying is that they are stepping up to the plate in many dramatic ways and finding themselves overwhelmed at this point because of the recession and needing for the state to step up and do its part as well. The presentation you just heard around TANF and child welfare services, strengthening those services so we don't have as many families facing hunger and the inability to provide, I think is really important.
Mm-hmm. And there was a news article about SNAP, is that what it's called these days?
SNAP. Mm-hmm.
The other thing that Frank worked on was to use farmers markets for food, but I understand that it's a 1% of the people who use that go to the farmers markets. For some reason,
Senator Morissette, there's more now. There's a couple of reasons why in some of the farmers markets they've provided some incentives for families on mm-hmm. SNAP, that for every dollar they spend on SNAP, they get another dollar, or they get twice as much of the fruits and vegetables. Those are privately funded efforts right now by New Seasons Market and some other foundations. But there's a look at the federal level about whether we can incentivize more the eating of fresh fruits and vegetables by providing some extra assistance to those families. Because, as you know, those are very expensive items in the market. Fruits and vegetables are more expensive than a lot of other items that are purchased.
Okay, that was the reason given why people don't go there. But what you're saying there,
in general, fruits and vegetables are more expensive. Fresh fruits and vegetables are more expensive than a lot of your starches and other packaged foods. Yes.
You're talking about the incentive.
Yes. Yeah, there are incentive programs in farmers markets. And now a lot of the farmers markets also have the machines so that SNAP recipients can go and use their SNAP benefit card to get tokens that they can use in the farmers
market. I think
there's
a public information gap there, maybe. I mean, people just are not aware. So, okay. Good. Thank you very much. Okay. Anybody else want to approach the bench? We're adjourned.
Goodness
gracious.